With the hyphen.
Modern hyphen day.
Yes.
Don't put a hyphen in dial-up, though, I don't think. Let's check that.
No, because modern day is a modifier of dial-up.
I know, but I mean, like, dial-up, I think, might be a hyphenated word.
Oh.
I gotta look.
I didn't think about that.
See, Wikipedia has it with the hyphen.
We can just choose not to, you know. That is something we could do.
I know, I'm just making sure without is even an option.
The Apple Dictionary only has it in the hyphenated form.
I know, I'm looking.
That's usually my reference as the dictionary app.
I think you have to have the hyphen. I think without the hyphen is not a thing.
Oh, this is hyphens run wild. The hyphens do not own you, gentlemen. Just choose not to. Well, it's going in without the hyphen.
No, you can't just make up your own words.
Modern hyphen day space dial-up.
No, dial-up isn't apparently not a word. If you don't put the hyphen there, the pens are going to all email us and say, you know, dial-up is not a word.
I really don't think anyone is going to email us.
Oh, are you kidding?
Challenge accepted.
I think we could get away with that one without a single email, actually. I think I'm on Casey's side of this bet. I don't think we would hear about it from anybody.
Does Chris Pepper listen to this podcast?
ultimately, John is going to go in and change it out from under us anyway, so I wouldn't worry.
Just put
about
the hyphen. Just be correct. No. Why would we intentionally not be correct? What are you making this stand about? What are you proving?
That I'm proving that I am better than a need to make the dial-up gods, the hyphen gods, happy.
What makes you better? What? There's no such thing as hyphen gods. So what are you trying to
because
say?
Because I am choosing. I am making a creative choice. I'm making a creative choice to not use the hyphen.
What are you expressing with that creative choice?
That I think the hyphens, too many hyphens. If we put,
you think there are too many hyphens? That's what you're expressing. This is the hill you're going to die on.
I mean, I would argue that I think if email lost its hyphen, which it did like forever ago, I would classify this as similar.
I feel like dial-up lived and died without ever losing its hyphen. Like, it's not going to lose its hyphen now, because who the hell ever talks about dial-up? It is a fossil.
We just did.
I think you should put the hyphen.
We are fossils.
I would like to lodge an official complaint to the group, please. I received an unsolicited package in the mail today, and Marco, you seem to have sent me the incorrect M6. You have sent me but a mere model as opposed to an actual M6. So I would like to officially file a complaint with the board that you have sent the incorrect sized M6. I literally can put it in my pocket, which means it is considerably too small. I mean, what is this, an M6 for ants?
It's last year's model. Why you got to send that back? Say, no, I'm sorry. The 6 isn't a thing anymore. It's the 8 now.
So all kidding aside, Marco sent me a BMW hat, which I already have one just like it, as did you, if I'm not mistaken, because I believe I got it from driving school. You sent me a mug, and you sent me a model M6. I believe that was it.
I think so.
Which was very kind of you to move your shit from your house to my house. Now I have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. But be that as it may, when you bought the i3, they just threw random swag at you?
Yes. Like when so
cool.
Yeah, for Tiff's recent i3 lease, they gave us like this bag on the way out of just a whole bunch of random BMW stuff.
Yeah, it's all last year's BMW stuff. That's why they're getting rid of it.
Yeah. Right. And we thought, well, we don't really need any of this stuff, but it would be funny to just mail it all to Casey. So that's what we did.
Thank you, yeah, so much.
You know how much he loves BMWs now.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, speaking of your poor car, I just saw something flipping through a magazine.
Hey, wait,
today.
Can we be more specific? Whose poor car are we speaking of?
Casey's poor car. I saw something flipping through a magazine today that seemed to indicate to me that the new Golf R will only come with an automatic.
Oh, no.
I believe it's pronounced Golf R.
That's what I saw in a graph, in a chart. You know, I don't think it's set in stone yet, but that seemed to be the indication of this chart. The other thing I learned is that the default transmission for the Golf in Europe is a stick, still, for the new generation one. Like, that's what you get if you don't select any options.
Well, and that's the thing is, here in America, if I were, actually, I'd be very curious to hear you guys, what you would say about this. But my question is, what is going to be the last car to get rid of the stick? And to me, I know, John, you're going to say the Civic, but I think if I were to wager a guess, I would say it'll be either the GTI or the Jeep Wrangler of all things. And I really mean that. John, I'm assuming you're going to say the Civic.
No, I'm not going to say the Civic. I think it's going to be some like weird, expensive, not exotic car. But, like, to give an example, I forget which car it was. Some car from some company. It might be Aston Martin. It might be one of those type of brands is introducing a new model that comes with a stick, like a new trim level of like an existing model where they just keep making different revisions of it. And one of the revisions is like, and this one comes with a stick, and it's just totally out of left field. And it's only there to satisfy a few weird people. Like, it's not even presented as a performance thing, like that type of thing where there's no reason for this, but you're already buying an Aston Martin. It wasn't Aston. It was some other car company, but you're already buying a car for like 200 and something grand. And we keep making new trim levels every year because we don't want to have to, you know, there's a long gap between the years. And so we make the one that has the pinstripe and the one with the big wing and the four wheel drive one and the convertible one. And then eventually they make one with the stick. And that's going to be the last car that's going to have a stick. It'll be an expensive novelty for very rich people on very expensive cars.
Okay, that's a fair answer. If I were to now move the goalposts and change it to be a car that like a regular human can buy, what would you say?
In the U.S.
In the U.S. In the U.S.
Maybe is the Civic still available with stick?
No, it's not. The Civic is not. If it was going to be a Honda, it would be like the Fit or something. But I'm thinking about if the economies of scale will get to the point where they're not going to do that either.
You got to figure like the Civic Type R would probably be a pretty good candidate for that because it's a pretty high selling, I think, car that like the audience would want it to be stick for a long time.
But it's also aspirational in that it aspires to, you know, a very fast automated manual or a very fast automatic because that's what the exotic cars all have. So it is, you know, the Ferraris don't have them anymore and the Civic wants to be a little mini Ferrari. So I feel like it's going to go that way. I'm going to go out of left field and say some Mazda, like the Miata.
Okay. Yeah, I can buy that. I've never driven a Miata. I've heard they are phenomenally fun. They are extremely slow, but phenomenally fun.
I think only Marco can fit in one, unfortunately. The three of us. They are very small. They're not small. Big.
So, Marco, back years and years ago when you were living in the dark ages and using dead dinosaurs to move you around from town to town, some of us chose to use a transmission that required you to have three pedals. That's what we call a stick. I know this is hard for you to remember now. if you remember those dark, dark, terrible days, if you were to guess which American affordable car would be the last car to have one of these just horrible devices, which would you guess?
Well, I just did. I guess the Civic Type R. I think that might be my final guess. Because I'm trying to think, like, because it would be something that's, like, I think we're almost out of the time period now where, like, people would just get it out of cheapness. Like, are there any cars left in the U.S. that have a stick as the base model just for cheapness?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, I think the Fit still does, to give an example. There's lots of... It's still happening now. I think your answer, Marco, should be the surprise answer, which you probably don't even want to hear, but electric cars are starting to come with transmissions. And if one doesn't already come with a manual, there will be an electric car with a manual transmission. As absurd as that sounds to you, I'm pretty sure there is one now as well.
Yeah, wasn't there?
Why?
I think there was like a one-off Mustang, if I'm not mistaken, that they put a stick in.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. It wasn't not the Mach-E, but there was some like electrified Mustang that had a manual transmission. Yeah. Why? They have transmissions for the same reason that gas cars have transmissions, to more efficiently put the power to the road. Like the Taycan, I can't do it. The Taycan has a two-speed transmission. It's not manual, obviously, but it has two speeds. So when you go highway cruising, your engines can be going at lower speed, and it's more efficient for battery power.
Is it that much more efficient?
Yeah, it shifts at like 60 when you're flat out. Yeah.
Oh.
So anyway, the possibility of electric cars with manual transmissions does exist, and so you should predict the last car that's going to have one is going to be. I mean, it still fits in my model of like some novelty expensive car. I just didn't say whether that car would be electric or not, but it could be.
Can you like feel the shift like you can like in a regular car?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing. It's just a power source and, you know, some kind of clutch that you actuate with a pedal with your left foot. And then you know, the whole nine yards, different gear ratios. And yeah.
Why would you want? I see. Look, the whole reason I like a stick or a DCT is because transmissions are terrible and the best transmission is no transmission. But if there's going to be one, I want to decide what it does. Damn it. But like, if you have a type of drivetrain like a pure electric that, for the most part, doesn't really need a transmission, why would you add one?
Well, as I said, you're adding it because it's more efficient. You get better mileage, like the two-speed and the Taycan, you get better acceleration numbers because you have the shorter gearing, you know, from a standstill. And then you have more efficient highway cruising because it's taller gearing. It's like the same reason the gas cars do. It's exactly it.
Why doesn't Tesla use the exact same setup then?
They're using like half the voltage that the Taycan is using, and there's all sorts of things about Tesla's original electric system that are different about the Porsche one. So the trade-offs Porsche is making allow it to charge faster, allow it to be slightly more efficient, allow it to have slightly better performance. I'm assuming the next-gen Tesla stuff will do all the same things, because everyone's going to that, whatever it is, 800-volt setup. So that's just sort of a generational thing. Doesn't mean they have to have a transmission. It just, you know, there's an advantage to it. Like, there's simplicity is the advantage of not having one, but you get some range and performance benefits to having one. It's only two speed, right? It's not like there's 900 gears or whatever. And the only reason you'd have a manual is, like I said, to satisfy weird people who want to shift themselves, because it's massively less efficient than letting it shift yourself.
If they only have two gears, can we bring back the turbo button that computers used to have?
Well, but then what would it do? Would that downshift into the lower gear? Because I think you can't, if you're over like 60, you can't be in the lower gear in the Taycan. Like, it's, you know, that's the end of the gear as far as, like, I don't know what you would press the button to make it do, because it's not really going to make you go any faster in any real situation. It can make you go slower. You could force it to upshift at 30, and then all of a sudden your car has worse performance.
Oh, man. I hope that day is coming, not at all soon, but it could be coming. The reason I was very confused about bad news for my car is because my car is actually currently at a body shop, because I got lightly rear-ended a week or two ago. And so young person in a what is that unremarkable Jeep, like a Compass or something like that?
All of them.
There's a lot of unremarkable Jeeps right now.
fair. But anyway, we were at a stoplight. It had just turned green. I was just about to take off, and I felt like a very subtle bump in the back, to the point that I honestly had thought I had stalled. That's how subtle it was. And then Aaron said, "We just get hit," and I stopped and I realized, oh, yes, we did. And so, because Virginia is a lovely, wonderful state, well, Commonwealth, strictly speaking, that does so many things right. Does so many things right, except we are monsters and require a front license plate. And so, one of the screws that was holding this individual's front license plate onto their car, kind of not punched a hole, but sort of kind of punched a hole in the paint, I guess you could say, of my bumper. And so, that's a thing. And it's been at the repair shop for a day and a half. And supposedly it's almost done.
You know, most people just live with that, you know.
No. Well, plus it wasn't my fault.
Like, I saw a picture of it. It's very small. You're going to pay for the entire repair yourself, because there's no way that's...
No, I did not.
You don't have any deductible?
I do have a deductible, but this individual bumped me, and so in order to... It was a very young person, and so I think their parents and they concluded that...
Oh, they just gave you some money.
Yeah, in order to alleviate dinging their insurance, which is also selfishly good for me, because I don't want this car to be forever tainted on, like, you know, Carfax or something like that. But anyways,
I don't think that kind of incident goes to Carfax.
Yeah, like, seriously, people, if you Marco should put a picture in the show art. We're talking about a tiny nick to the paint the size of a dime.
That's
like a ring
accurate.
The size of a dime, not even a complete ring.
Yep, that's pretty accurate.
On the plastic bumper. That, yes, it went through the paint to the plastic, but that's it. It's like a ring the size of a dime.
I'm pretty sure every car I've ever had has incurred damage like that. And like these like leases that I would turn in, and they wouldn't even comment on it. I wouldn't get charged. Like, it's that minor.
Mm-hmm. Well, $500 later, it will be fixed.
Yeah, so that's not a $500 ding. Like,
hey, man.
I feel you, because I have the same attitude towards things and scratches in my car. Of course I do, right? But I let them build up. Like, so I have done bumper repair on my car, and I let it get pretty bad. Like, you know, large, big, scratchy regions where, like, cement chips off the road and scratched my thing, and, like, you know, bumps from who knows what in the parking lot, and just all sorts of stuff that happens to my car when I'm not there. And I was like, all right. And my car is black, so, and like, it's scraping through and making these horrible, like, white paint for other people's cars. Eventually it built up to the point where I could plunk down an obscene amount of money to get my plastic bumper repaired. But if you do it every time, that's expensive.
That's fair. But no, it really bothered me, and I wanted to get it fixed. And since I was bumped in the back, you know, it's pretty much guaranteed not to be my fault. And we actually did call a police officer, which I have a question about that in a second. We called a police officer just to see what happened. And the gentleman was very nice, the police officer, but he basically looked at the car and said, that's less than, I think he said, $1,500 worth of damage. And so I'm not even going to write this up. Suddenly, an
insurance adjuster, he knows it's less than $1,500. Like, if you drove a Ferrari, that would not be less than $1,500.
That's very fair. But he didn't write it up. And so he was just like, here's a form for you to write each other's information down and go away. What I don't understand, though, is why didn't the individual that bumped me get some sort of citation? It didn't occur to me until after I had driven away and it was all over. Like, yeah, they didn't do a whole bunch of damage, but they still bumped another car. Like, shouldn't that individual have gotten written like some sort of ticket? If you're a law enforcement officer and have information about this, I would not me specifically, just in general, I would love to hear why this person wasn't written up or given a ticket for having hit another car.
As we know, many things are at the discretion of law enforcement officers.
Yeah, I mean, I know.
I think that's the answer.
I mean, I think the job of police officers largely is like, the world is going to try to shove all of their problems onto your plate. You, as the police officer, have to decide, like, what is worth my time and what isn't.
And what's worth the paperwork.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like that's probably why, like, they probably get called out for every dumb little thing. And, you know, if they can get rid of some stuff, get it off their plate, I'm sure they're very happy to do that. So I'm sure the officer saw what happened here, saw it was incredibly minor, and it not only was it not worth like filing a police report for the accident, it wasn't even worth citing the person because it's like, who cares?
Yeah, it's not a criminal matter. They weren't reckless driving. They're not drunk. You know, like it's totally a civil matter.
Oh, that's interesting. You don't think that there was any law broken? I mean, they hit another car.
Is that illegal?
I don't know. Like that's why I think your question is an interesting one. Like I don't like there's fault and there's the insurance and there's all sorts of you could sue the person and have sorts of civil cases or whatever, but the laws about driving are about obeying traffic signs and not being intoxicated and not driving recklessly and all that other stuff. And there's probably some law that you could cite.
What about following too close? I mean, there's a rule about not following too close, and this individual broke that rule.
Weren't you stationary? Like maybe? Yeah, I'm sure somewhere on the books is a thing that says you shouldn't hit another car. When if the car in front of you doesn't go, you don't go either. Like I'm sure that's in there, but I don't know how. Whatever the lowest level of infraction is, I would imagine this would have to be it. And I don't know what that's called. It's not a misdemeanor. I don't know. Anyway, that's why I'm actually interested in the answer to this question of some police officer wants to write in, because I have no idea what they would be cited for. Well, I do agree that you, as I think we discussed on a past show, the whole thing about driving is you don't let the cars touch.
Yeah, that is kind of goal number one.
Did we talk about that here, or was that?
I think so. That was in neutral, if I'm not mistaken.
There you go. Don't let the cars touch, Casey.
Well, you know what? I was trying not to, but apparently somebody...
Takes two to touch.
Thanks, Dad.
We are sponsored this week by Linode, my favorite web host. They host all of my servers, and I absolutely am a huge fan of Linode. Whatever you want to build, you can build it on Linode. If you need dedicated servers, they give you dedicated CPU. They give you distributed application hosting, hosted services, websites, CI/CD environments, whatever you can do on a dedicated virtual server, that's what you can build at Linode. Whether it's one small server with their little $5 a month plan, which you can do quite a bit with, all the way up to huge complex systems. Like I run at Overcast, I run about 25 or 30 instances there right now. And it's just super easy. I've been there forever, since long before they were a sponsor. And I just absolutely love working with Linode. It is great to host stuff there. They have a great value. They have great performance. Tons of different options. So for instance, you can host your servers in any of their 10 data centers worldwide, and they're always adding more. You can also bill hourly for all the services, and they all have monthly caps. So if you need a server for like a day or two, fine, you pay the hourly rate. Once you hit the monthly price of that server, it just stays there. So you're never like overpaying. You always just only pay for what you use, and that's it. It's all super easy too. If you need service, support, they are great on that. They have a whole API, so you can automate stuff if you need to. It's just wonderful. Check out Linode today for all your server hosting needs. Whatever you want to build, you can build at Linode. Go to linode.com/ATP, and you can get a $20 credit with promo code ATP2019. Now, I mentioned earlier, their lowest plan starts at just $5 a month. It's a server with 1 gig of RAM, so that credit could be 4 months free. Once again, linode.com/ATP, promo code ATP2019 for that $20 credit. Thank you so much to Linode for hosting all my servers and sponsoring our show.
All righty, let's do a little bit of follow-up. Marco, you apparently would like to file a report of your own with regard to the Paperlike 2. Is that a Kindle? I don't even know.
Good guess. No, we talked on this show about a year ago I had tried out a screen protector for my iPad called the Paperlike. I loved the way that it felt, because the iPad Pro has the feeling, especially when you first get the new one, when it's all clean and not covered in finger grease, it's almost tacky. Like, you need like a kind of a smoother surface, and like your fingers almost get caught in it. It's so, like, you know, bare and such a large surface. But then, unfortunately, the iPad Pro also has a fairly weak oleophobic coating, the thing that rejects finger oils, because ever since the iPad Pro came out with pencil support, apparently it's been a thing that Apple has not been able to figure out, and an oleophobic coating that is compatible with the Apple Pencil that is any good. And so the result is any iPad since then is a fingerprint magnet, way more than the previous ones were. And so the iPad screen is always just covered in finger grease. Anyway, so I was trying a screen protector last year called the Paperlike, that advertises that it feels like paper, so it's better at, like, a better texture for when you're drawing with the pencil and everything. And I hardly ever actually do that, but I did like the idea of a matte finish screen protector, because not only did it improve that, like, slippery finger feel and you know, make it easier to, like, do swipe gestures and everything, but also it seemed to lessen the fingerprint problem. The downside was that it kind of blurred and added, like, rainbow light refraction noise to the picture quality on the iPad. So it felt better, and it looked better when it was off because it wasn't covered in greasy fingerprints. But when it was on, the picture quality was sacrificed too much. Like, it was just, it blurred the image too much, and it had this kind of, like, rainbow refraction noise around, you know, everything. And so I eventually took it off, which, again, immediately made it feel worse again, and it was immediately covered in fingerprints. But I did take it off eventually, because I just didn't find the picture quality trade-off acceptable. The Paperlike 2 has just come out. I backed it on Kickstarter a while ago, and the reason I gave it another shot is that they specifically addressed that picture quality thing in the Kickstarter campaign materials for it. They basically said, like, they basically created a nano coating texture. Very, very similar advertising to what Apple said they did with the Pro Display XDR's anti-glare $1,000 option.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that you had to spend $1,000 on the screen protector.
Well, it turns out it was only like $25-$30, something like that. So that's it impossible. Is possible. It is possible to do it more cheaply. I got it today. I have it installed. And so far, I am pleasantly surprised by it. Granted, I have not had a lot of time with it yet, but it is a huge improvement in how much of the screen quality gets reduced, but there is still some picture quality reduction. There is still a little bit of blurring and a little bit of that rainbow noise effect, but it's significantly lessened than the last generation one, and it's much less than any other matte screen protector I've ever used before, which admittedly I haven't used that many in recent years because retina screens kind of ruin them. But this does look very good. It does not look as good as the Pro Display XDR's anti-glare coating, but it also isn't made of glass and $1,000. So, you know, to give them credit, like, if you like screen protectors, or if you are interested in trying one, Paperlike 2 is actually, it seems to be the real deal. So I'm going to keep it on for a while. I don't know if I'm going to stick with it long term yet, but I'm at least going to keep it on for a little while, because I really like the way it feels, and I really like how it immediately got rid of all my fingerprints all over my screen. So, yeah, I'll report back in future episodes on whether I still have it or not, but I'm tentatively optimistic about it. And the one thing I really wish now, I would love to have this for the MacBook Pro.
So who has Tiff used this, tried it on your iPad or on hers?
Not yet.
Because I'm wondering what, you know, she does, I'm assuming, a lot more drawing than you do on her iPad. Way more. How it feels for the supposed intended purpose feeling like paper. Like, you want it for the fingerprinty stuff, but I'm interested to see if she likes it for the drawing parts.
I mean, I also just enjoy the way it feels on my fingers. Like, that's, it feels good, and it doesn't have the screen all fingerprinty, and that's awesome.
Oh, and also, if you want, you could probably buy like 9 of these and put them on your Display XDR and save yourself a lot of money. Just try to ignore the seams and the part where the rounded corners don't meet. Yeah, it'll be fine.
Totally fine. Word.
Well, I'm glad you found something that that you enjoy. Tell me, Marco, about MacBook Pro pricing.
What?
That's not Marco's topic. That's mine.
I was hoping that was Marco's, but you know what? As I've learned many times and always deny, it's always John, you guys. Mm-hmm. It's always John.
Yeah. So last week when we talked about the new 16-inch MacBook Pro, we talked about almost everything about it except one item, which is the price. And the price is interesting in that it's not interesting. So this the new 16-inch MacBook Pro, it has a bigger screen. It has much better speakers. It has a much better microphone. It has a much better keyboard. It has a bigger battery in it. It has a better GPU. But it's the same price as the one it replaces, more or less. I'm sure there's differences in the models, but it starts at the same price. And so they didn't increase the price. They didn't say, oh, well, this is a 16-inch, so it's going to be an extra $50 or an extra $20 or an extra $100. It's more or less the same price, which is nice. And we didn't mention it. I thought we should.
Yeah, exactly. This is one thing that we all got wrong in the guesses. Like, everyone thought, because Apple really has been doing a lot of price raising in recent years. Whenever they change a generation of a product, price usually goes up. And in this case, it didn't. We were shocked. We were so sure that it would be more expensive than the current ones that a common guess in the rumor mill was that this would actually sit above the 15-inch, and the 15-inch would stay in the lineup for price reasons. And that didn't happen here. They just replaced the 15 with one that's better, and it's the exact same price. And additionally, the SSD capacities doubled for the two configurations that are like the stock ones, like the $2,400 and $2,700 ones, used to be 256 and 512 on the SSD, and now it's 512 and 1 terabyte respectively. So they doubled the SSD sizes on both too, which is wonderful, because now we've returned to the point now where, like, I feel like I can confidently recommend the base model again. Like, for years I was saying, hey, well, you should get the base model, it's a great buy, except 256 on the SSD is pretty tight. I wouldn't recommend that. Now, I do recommend, because 512, I think, is the minimum anybody should have. And I usually go for the terabyte on mine these days. But yeah, 512 is a perfectly fine minimum. And so the base model is recommendable once again. So to have this, this new computer that is substantially better in some pretty important ways, be the same price, and also give double SSD from where it was before. I know SSD pricing is really cheap these days. Yes, 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 I know. But the fact that we have this now is pretty good.
Yeah, I actually went to the local Apple store today to check out the new MacBook Pro.
Do you have one yet?
We're going to talk about this later. we're going to talk about this later, but I...
You do, don't you?
I do want the new MacBook Pro, but here's the thing. It is a aircraft carrier compared to what I'm used to. And remember, I have the 12-inch MacBook. It's not obnoxiously heavy by comparison. Now, granted, I didn't have a MacBook next to it to compare to, but just... by picking up the MacBook Pro, it's not terribly thick. It's not terribly heavy, but just in surface area alone, like the footprint of the thing is just comically, comically large. And I just don't know if I want something that big. But I've been starting to have, as we've talked about, and we will talk about later, I've been starting to have problems with the iMac again. And so I'm starting to wonder, maybe I should just get this 16-inch MacBook Pro and a, LG 5K abomination and just call it a day and just, stop having a desktop anymore. And I'm going to need you two to argue with me and convince me not to do that here in a little bit. But one way or another, the keyboard is excellent. It is very, very good. It feels very much like the Magic Keyboard. It feels ever so slightly less mushy to me. Again, I didn't have a Magic Keyboard like next to it to compare, but from what I could remember of typing on a Magic Keyboard, it felt slightly less mushy, which I thought was good. I don't find the Magic Keyboard to be particularly mushy, but it felt slightly less mushy. But it is very, very good, and it felt extremely similar to the Magic Keyboard. So based on 30 to 60 seconds with it, two thumbs way, way, way up, I really like the keyboard, and it seems like it's exactly what we've always wanted, which, again, Marco covered last week, but now you have somebody else saying that, Marco's right. Marco, you did buy one or no?
Yes, I did. So
what did you buy?
I went into the store and just bought the $2,799 stock model. In like a perfectly ideal world, maybe I would have gone 32 gigs and 2 terabytes for like future expansion, but I know myself well enough to know a couple of things. A, I'm impatient. I wanted my own now. Now, I still do have Apple's review in it because I haven't had to send it back yet, but when you have a review, like I didn't want to like fully move into it. Like, I didn't want to like have to like transfer over certain activation software licenses and stuff like that. Like, there's like a bunch of stuff that, when you get a new laptop, you kind of like move into it fully. And I didn't want to do all that to the review loaner knowing that, you know, within a matter of weeks, I would have to send it back and do the whole thing again, right? So I wanted to get my own fairly soon so I could really, you know, complete that move-in process and only have to do it once. And I also, you know, I looked at the 13-inch MacBook Pro I've been using for the last year and a half. It only had 16 gigs of RAM and 1 terabyte, and that had been fine for me for my laptop needs. You know, it'd be different if it was my primary computer and I was doing heavy development work as my primary computer. Then I might spec it up a little bit more. But 16 and 1 terabyte was fine for my needs. It was perfectly fine for the last year and a half. So I know that, A, that's probably going to be fine, you know, for the time I have this laptop. B, I also know myself. And I know I'm probably only going to have this laptop for, you know, a year and a half or whatever. Ha!
That's funny. That's very funny. If you make it a month and a half, I'll be impressed.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the big test is going to be when they do come out with this keyboard in a 13-inch. Then
exactly.
That's going to be the big, big test, because I, too, look at this thing and think, this is an aircraft carrier. This is way bigger than what I am accustomed to. Because I'm coming off the 13 for, you know, as I said, for a year and a half. So I'm accustomed to a much smaller computer than this. That being said, I did use a 15-inch for years before that and liked it. So I might stick with it. Either way, 16 and 1 terabyte were fine with me, and I wanted the 8-core, and that has the 8-core. So I am very, very happy with just that regular $27.99 stock config, and I was able to get it very quickly. Like on day, I got it on day one, so I got to move into it fully, and here I am. So when I eventually want to sell it to you in, you know, a few months when the 13-inch comes out, let me know. And
no way, because I'm going to get a 13. I genuinely think if they had come out with what presumably would be a 14-inch, you know, we're saying the same thing, you know, the 13-inch with the new keyboard, et cetera, et cetera. I think I would have insta-bought it the day it came out, just like you did with this, or maybe at most I would order a slightly different config. But if they had a new 13 with a new keyboard, I would have already bought one. And I'm a little scared. Was it Jonathan Morrison? Did I get that name right? I forget who it was, but somebody did a interview with Phil Schiller on that day, and asked basically, hey, so, you know, presumably the 14 is coming out soon, right? And I forget exactly how it was answered, but Phil kind of pumped the brakes on that more than I would have expected. So I'm a little nervous that that's going to be like many, many months in the future, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that's always a possibility. But I think his statement was, I mean, he's not going to say that they're coming. He can't say that they're coming. And the harder you press on that question, the more forcefully he has to say, not say that they're coming. He has to say, we sell the Butterfly one and this one right now. We are continuing to sell the Butterfly, because that's the truth. And if you keep pressing, he keeps having to say that over and over again, and it makes you start thinking, oh my God, they're never going to replace it. But they will. It's just a matter of time. Like, it may be way too long, and we may be angry in 2 years screaming that the MacBook Air still doesn't have this keyboard. But he can't, he literally can't say anything differently now. So I saw that too, and it didn't make me feel any better or any worse about the prospects. Just people want to be reassured, and that reassurance is not coming from a company that is currently selling Butterfly keyboards.
I'm starting to lose faith that the 13-inch replacement will become 14 inches. The kind of thing that usually leaks pretty far ahead of time these days, usually through Ming-Chi Kuo, is when display panel sizes and resolutions change. For something that we expect to be launching in less than a year and probably less than 6 months, the fact that we haven't had a display panel leak about a 14-inch display panel coming out soon is concerning. And in fact, I believe Ming-Chi Kuo or one of the, you know, common rumor mill people has even said recently that it's going to be 13.3 still. So I'm guessing it's actually probably not going to go to 14, which I hope I'm wrong, because I would love for it to. But it doesn't seem like that's in the cards yet, or at least if it is in the cards, they have dramatically improved their secrecy around display panel leaks, which previously were leaking all the time very reliably.
Yeah, I haven't seen any rumors of a 14. Like, the only reason we're talking about a 14 is because it would be cool and it's what we all want. But, like, what I've never, besides wishful thinking on our part and the fact that it seems like a cool idea, I haven't seen anything about it. We're still treating it as a thing that Apple should do. But, you know, I don't know what the lead times are on panels. Maybe there's, if the thing comes out in 8 months, maybe there's still time for a panel leak, but who knows? But yeah, and it's firmly in the category of cool thing that we think Apple should do and not thing that we think Apple is going to do necessarily at this point.
Yeah, and to be fair, I'm not bent on it being a 14-inch. Like, if they came out with the exact same panel, like you're saying, Marco, but, you know, the new keyboard and presumably slightly better internals, etc., I would still insta-buy that, too. Like, I'm not hanging my hat on an additional inch of display. I'm hanging it on the new keyboard. Because as it turns out, as I was driving, well, Aaron was driving me to Apple because I have no car, I was trying to do some work on my Adorable and the H key was sticking and it was one other key that was sticking. And I'm just thinking to myself, it's probably for the best that I don't have my business credit card on me because I might have pulled a Marco right then and there, which is...
I never have problems with the butterfly keyboard.
Well, I mean, I'm sure I can take compressed air to it, but I didn't have compressed air handy in the passenger compartment.
You just held his notebook out the window while they were driving.
Yeah, right.
At exactly a 70-degree angle or whatever. Now, I have to ask you, though, Marco, these are two interrelated questions. I was going to ask, do you think this will be the computer for all trips to the beach, only weekend trips to the beach? But given that you didn't spec up the RAM to 32 gigs, I'm guessing that you will use this for brief trips, but then still use your ridiculous carrying case for your summer move.
That is my plan, is like when I'm out there for the whole summer, still bring in my desktop just because I want a desktop. I want like the giant monitor. You know, I want all the power. I want no fan noise. I want 100% reliability. Like for me, like I love having a desktop out there for that large span. But this will make it so that I am much happier and more productive when I'm not going somewhere for 2 months. you know, when I'm just going like for a weekend or for a week. Or when I'm going other places. You know, I do, in other parts of the year, I do go to other places sometimes.
Sure. And,
decreasingly so, maybe, but I still do go, you know, like for WWDC. Like there's all sorts of times when I travel where I need to or want to get work done that I can't bring my iMac Pro on trips like that. And this will be wonderful for all of those other trips, even if I don't use it full time for my, like, you know, big summer move.
That's fair. Yeah, I don't know. I keep wrestling with, should I just, you know, ditch the iMac entirely and just get one of these and a monitor? But we'll see. We'll talk about that in a minute. Moving on, before we do that, let's talk about keycap replacement. And apparently there's news about this. Peter Wells tweeted at the two of you guys and said that he asked about repairability. And Phil said that if a key gets stuck, you can pop it off and replace it. What a novel idea.
Serviceability. Wow.
And there's a demo video from iFixit demonstrating that. It's basically was like their teardown of the thing and looking at the keyboard and talking about it. But, you know, they took it apart. They looked at the mechanism inside it and they were comparing it to like the Magic Keyboard and looking at the different pieces. And lo and behold, not only can you pop off a keycap and put it back on, what they did was they popped the keycap off of the Magic Keyboard and popped it right onto the 16-inch MacBook Pro. Fits just fine. Now, the keycaps on the Magic Keyboard are a little bit taller, like they're thicker, right? So I probably wouldn't replace all the keycaps and then close the lid because I think they would probably hit into the screen or whatever. But it just goes to show exactly how close those mechanisms are to each other, despite them being different because it's not at an angle and them having whatever these stabilizing pins, blah, blah, blah. The fact is they popped off like the command key and off of the 16-inch MacBook Pro and put on the one from the Magic Keyboard. So there you go. It, you know, it is as close to the Magic Keyboard as it can be without being the Magic Keyboard. And you can indeed open up at a single key and put it back on. Now, all that said, as someone, like I said, who has pop the keycaps off a scissor switch Apple keyboard and put one back on, you can screw this up, rest assured. Like, there are still delicate parts in there. You could, you know, if you have experience and know how to do it, you'll be successful. But if you're just like, I can do this, let me just rip this thing off, they're very small, tiny pieces of plastic. And if you bend or break one of those little tiny pieces of plastic, you need a new tiny piece of plastic, which is still a possibility for repair, and that's great and everything. But don't be too cavalier about ripping your thing apart. The good thing is that an Apple repair person who presumably has vast experience taking off keycaps and putting them back on can do this for you. So yay for repairability.
John, take me on a trip down memory lane with regard to mics and getting better over time.
This is just a thought I had, you know, thinking about our last discussion about the improved microphones and speakers and stuff like that on the MacBook Pros and how cool it was and how it wasn't really top of mind because we were all focused on the keyboard and everything else, but it's this nice surprise. And I know I've talked about this before on ATP, but, you know, with the show running this long, I don't feel too bad repeating myself because two of you have probably forgotten about it by now, too. But, and I can't remember if I did talk about it, but I like, as an old person, I like to sort of wax nostalgic about a particular period in the history of the Mac. Like right in the beginning, when the Mac first came out, there was this brief period of time. Well, actually, there was a longer period of time that you're both familiar with of like the PC industry. But for the Mac specifically, there was this brief period of time where the Mac was brand new. In the beginning, there was one computer. It was called Macintosh, spelled out completely. And that was it. There was no qualifiers on that. There was no designation because what you need, it was literally the only one, Macintosh, right? And then new ones came out, you know, the 512 and the Plus and the SE and all that stuff, right? During that initial run of like a new machine would come out and then another one and then another one, for a while there, every new Mac that came out was better than its predecessor in pretty much every way. And every aspect of the system would get improved because we were sort of in that era of computing. The CPU was faster. There were no GPUs. You don't have to worry about that. It had more ports. The floppy drive was bigger. The floppy drive was faster. The screen was a little bit sharper. The speakers were a little bit louder. The sound chip had could do, you know, higher kilohertz or higher bit depth or whatever. Everything about it was better. The keyboard was better. The mouse was better. It was like, and that continued for like 3, 4, or 5 models, depending on when things bifurcated into the Mac 2 and the color and everything and how you count that. And that just, you know, because that was a formative time in my life and I was super into the Mac and everything, it seemed like that's the way computers are. Every time a new one comes out, it's better than all the ones that came before it, because why wouldn't it be? In every aspect that it could be. Obviously, there's some aspects that are the same or whatever, but there were certainly never any regressions. And in general, if you could touch it or if it affected your experience with the computer, it got better. As we all know now, that has long since not been the case. New computers come out and they improve in the few ways that are the most important, but other parts stay the same for a long time. And in general, like I was referring to your experience and our collective experience of the PC industry, if you were to graph anything having to do with like the advance of computers in the beginning, going from like the first personal computers to maybe like the 2000s or something, there's this big run up where like every computer is so much better than the one that came before it. Moore's Law is in full effect. You got Weird Al singing parody songs where the entire premise is the idea that you get a computer and then before you even take it out of the box, it's obsolete because some other computer you can get for the same amount of money is like twice as fast. That doesn't happen. We wait 3 years now for a computer that's 20% faster. There's lots of reasons for that. We've discussed it on the show. But all this is to say is there was a period where everything seemed like it was improving. And there was an expectation from the consumer and an excitement from the consumer that if I get a new computer, of course the speakers are going to be better. Of course the microphone is going to be better because this is this year's model. And that was last year's model. And this year they have a way to make insert component here better. And the speakers and the microphone are things that I interact with, so they should be better. In our modern era, especially on the Mac line, we accept the idea that, for example, the webcam, as we call it, which is a ridiculous name, the front-facing camera on our Apple laptops will just go years and years without getting better. And not because it's reached any kind of limit. Like, very often the camera is poor quality and low resolution and has bad dynamic range and the lens is not great. But every year we're not like, I can't believe they didn't upgrade the camera this year. We don't even mention it because it's one of those things that we consider to be in stasis. Now, you could say that's because it's good enough, but honestly, it's not good enough. Like if you look at the front-facing camera of the phone, which itself doesn't change every single time to be fantastically better, but it does try to keep pace. The front-facing camera on the iPhone has been improving, albeit more slowly. And so our discussion of the mic and speakers made me reflect on how, not how complacent, but how I've gotten used to the idea that certain things don't change. Even when we, you know, we touched on this last week saying like, oh, now we can get back to lobbying for Face ID on Macs or whatever. I would like to see, one of the things I would like to see now we're getting everything we want, you know, we want even more in this sort of revival of the Mac is exactly what they just demonstrated on the 16-inch MacBook Pro. An improvement to systems that we had basically given up on. Like Marco says, he wasn't even thinking about laptop speakers being better. And the microphone, who ever thought about that getting better? And now you know, it's reawoken me and said, yeah, why shouldn't the front-facing camera on laptops be better every once in a while? When's the last time that changed? And you think, oh, you don't use it that much. I actually use it all the time. When I'm like teleconferencing with people who are in different geographic regions of my company, I'm using video. And what video? The camera that's in my computer. It affects like how I present myself to my coworkers. And if it can't handle the darkness in the room or it keeps changing like its exposure level because it's getting confused by like bright light coming through the window or whatever. And the same thing with the microphone. I sound echoey and distant. And, you know, those are all things that can and should be improved. So I don't know. I don't know what my point here is, except that I am now ready for more changes like the one that just happened in the 16-inch. So I'm happy that Apple did that, and they should be a little bit scared that they did it, because now I'm just getting more demanding.
This is one of the things that I'm so happy to be back to this now. Like, for these last few years where we've had the keyboard being this huge problem for a lot of people and being this huge thing that we hated, it was hard to look at anything else about the laptops and to really have a wish list, or to really be able to focus on, like, where, how else could they make technology get better, and how else could they improve these things that we use every day? Because it was like when your house is on fire, literally, if your house is on fire, it's really hard to look at the bathroom and be like, I'd like to remodel this. Like, it's like you have to deal with the fire first, right? And so the keyboard fire is being put out. On the big one, it's already out. It's going to be put out on the smaller ones, we hope, soon. So, like, now that the fire is being put out, it allows us to then finally revisit anything else about it, anything else besides, like, the primary input mechanism being incredibly controversial and having a high failure rate, right? So I am very much looking forward to a return to that kind of normalcy. And yeah, there's a bunch of stuff that I don't think they've advanced enough in recent years, because, you know, they, who knows what they were doing. Regardless, you know, their heads weren't on right for a while, and it seems like now they put them back on. And so I would love things like, as I mentioned before, cellular. And I think there might be some movement there. Maybe we'll get to this. There was a thing somewhere on a document that I saw about that. But, like, I think it is long past time to have cellular on laptops. PC laptops have had it for a decade. I don't know why Apple has resisted so far. I've been told that there have been good reasons. I'm sure there are good reasons, but that doesn't mean they're insurmountable. If there is enough of a will, they can get past things that have good reasons. Other stuff, like, you know, is this, as John said, like, is this the best webcam that we can have, really? Because the webcam on it is still really crappy compared to...
Stop calling it webcam.
Sorry, the FaceTime
front-facing camera.
Yeah, the front-facing camera is still really crappy. It hasn't advanced at all in a very long time. The front-facing camera on iPhones is way better than the one on a $2,400 MacBook Pro, and I'm not sure that's right. You know, I know there's different depths and everything. There's different, you know, price, you know, things, but...
We just want to see progress, like...
Yeah. I still don't think we've solved the ports and SD card problem, really. You know, we've kind of kicked the can down the road a little bit, but the problem is still there. I still think that the ports that are on the laptop should be such that most people don't need a single dongle, and I don't think we've reached that point. You know, there's all sorts of things that I think we can improve. I think battery life can always be improved, and we are just now, I think we are barely on the right side of that, where, like, most people most of the time will have just barely enough battery life, but I think we can do better than that. And there's still too many cases where, like, you have to be really careful, otherwise you won't have any battery life. And, you know, that I still think we need software support for things like a true low power mode for Mac OS, which I blogged about like a year or two ago. But I still think, you know, give us a low power mode that can disable turbo boost, that can turn off spotlight indexing and photo analysis, and a whole bunch of other, like, power sucking things on Mac OS, that, you know, if you need to get through a 6-hour flight and actually be doing something like Xcode or something that's actually taxing the battery, and you have no power on that flight, you can put your laptop in low power mode and be relatively confident that you'll make it. You know, there's all sorts of stuff like this. And for so long, the tech industry has been so focused on what's next, what else, what's the future of computing, in the way that they kind of have declared laptop and desktop style computing as dead, but we're all still doing it every single day for much or all of our work. So I think it's about time for not only Apple, but for much of the industry to refocus on, you know, the kind of, like, regular or old style computer, and be like, how can we bring this forward? How, you know, how much can we put into this? For a while, we thought this was the past, this was done. Turns out tablets and phones and everything were mostly additive, and all these computers that we all thought were done aren't done. We're all still using them. So let's keep moving them forward.
I think the PC industry has actually been moving forward on all these fronts, because the PC industry is not just one company. It's like, you know, one company fades, another company rises, you know, but there's lots of innovation there. You see,
I guess it is mostly an Apple problem.
Yeah. So we're obviously we're mostly focusing on Apple. But that's just the nature of a single company versus an entire rest of the industry, because if a particular company, you know, stops really trying to sell PC notebooks, someone else will come and eat their lunch, right? Whereas Apple stops really trying, because they have such a differentiator with the OS and the whole platform and all the other things that we've talked about, they have less, there's less competition, there's less pressure on them to change. So they can leave the camera on their laptops the same for 5 years, 6 years, how long has it been the same? And no competitor is going to steal that customer because no one else sells Mac laptops.
It does make me happy, as you mentioned earlier, Marco. It makes me happy that we are now finding these sorts of things to grumble about rather than one of the two primary input mechanisms for the computer not working very reliably. Like, this is definitely
a better. I had a terrible flash earlier today about thinking of, like, wouldn't it be funny / horrifying if the next thing was that a Mac laptop came out and the trackpad was unreliable?
Yeah, imagine how bad that would be, John. We're going to talk about that in a minute.
No, not the external one. And that's a software problem anyway, probably.
Well, but it's like imagine if an iPad, every iPad that came out for 3.5 years, 1 minute out of every hour, it just wouldn't recognize touches. Like, and they kept releasing iPads for 3 years that kept doing that.
Didn't the iPhone 4, one of them had like a flex cable issue where it was like home button disease or something, where like the cable would disconnect from like the touch sensor and it would stop accepting touch input or something.
iPhone 6, I believe.
Well, yeah, whatever it was, that was like a one-time problem. They fixed it by like fixing the cable or whatever. But yeah, stuff like that happens occasionally. But yeah, it's just, hopefully none of them will be this kind of long nightmare. It's like, well, the trackpad works most of the time. Occasionally you'll swipe on it and the cursor will move, but that happens in like one out of every 10,000 swipes. It's not a big deal, and we'd all just slowly be going mad over the next 3 years.
No, thank you. Marco, you made mention of somewhere in the document there was some sort of chatter about cellular laptops. Well, guess what? It is right after what we just covered. So,
cool.
John,
it's time.
Tell me about Lakefield System on a Chip and cellular laptops, please.
Yeah, there's an article from AnonTech talking about some new Intel chips that incorporate some cellular tech in them. And the article talks about a particular model of some Samsung thing. And it says, like, you know, you could always put cellular in x86 notebooks, but then you got to put separate chips and take more power. And of course, they cost more money or whatever. So here's something from Intel to make it easier for you to efficiently and presumably less expensively put cellular in a laptop. And again, PC laptops had cellular forever. This is just something making it easier. But it's making me think that regardless of which direction Apple goes, we keep talking about their ARM transition, if and when that's ever going to happen. And of course, if it did, you would presume that bringing cellular along with that would be really easy, because Apple has a lot of experience making very powerful system on chips based on the ARM architecture, which have cellular capability, even though they also have separate chips and yada, yada, yada. But anyway, even if they stick to Intel, it seems like Intel has products in the pipe that could help some of Apple's laptops have cellular capability with more power savings and less expense than even before. So the number of excuses for Apple not to have cellular continues to dwindle.
Which is good news. You know, and just to hopefully get in front of all the people that are going to write us and say, well, why don't you tether? Having done that in the car today, let me tell you, it is not fun. I know we cover this a lot, but people always ask, well, why don't you just tether?
Tethering sucks.
It's not nearly as convenient. It is way more convenient to turn the machine on and instantly have a connection of its own, rather than having to wait for it to realize it doesn't have a connection, and then wait for it to realize you have a phone nearby. And then often, but not always, it will be smart enough to offer you, in Catalina anyway, offer you that connection on your phone, or even on Mojave, you could, you know, go into the Wi-Fi menu and drop down and grab your phone from the list. But that's still many more steps. You're now depleting two different batteries. It's just not as darn convenient. And I don't understand why people get such a burr up their butts about us not liking tethering. Yes, I do tether a lot on my laptop, but if I could, I would love to have a cellular laptop. And so I really don't enjoy people constantly saying, oh, you should just tether. Yes, we get it. We don't want to. That's the whole point.
Well, and like, you know, just because a solution is good enough for you doesn't mean that no one could possibly want a better one for themselves and for their needs and priorities, right? Like it's all, when people say like just Tether, it's, they're saying it like defensively because they just Tether and it's fine for them. So why can't it be fine for us? And you know, again, like it, this is something that a lot of people never understand, but like just because you don't need something doesn't mean that no one needs it, right? Or just because your priorities say this is fine doesn't mean that other people would make the same choice, right? And in the case of tethering, like, yeah, tethering is fine if it's your only option, which currently for laptops made by Apple, it is. But, you know, when we went from, you know, we're all old enough, everyone listening, we're all old enough, the three of us, to have been around when broadband came out. And more importantly, to have been around before broadband came out. And one of the big changes that happened when you went from dial-up to broadband, yes, it did get a ton faster, but it was also always connected. You were just always online. Your computer was just always online, as opposed to having to go to a thing in your menu bar or whatever and say, connect to the internet, please, wait a few seconds, and then have it connect. That's exactly what tethering is.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. Yeah,
it's literally exactly what it is. You're basically doing modern-day dial-up. You are having to go to your menu and go to the thing and say, dial with my phone, please. Like, tether with my phone, please. And wait a few seconds, and then you're on. It is totally different to be out there in the world and to pick up your iPad or your iPhone with cellular and to just be online. You're just on. That's it. You just open it up and it's online. Like, simple as that. Totally different way of operating. And that is why I want this in a MacBook. There's so many times where I will take my iPad out into the world instead of a laptop, primarily because of cellular. Because it's just easier. It's just always on. It's just there, right? I want that for the Mac as well. And it totally transforms the way you use a portable device, whether it can have cellular or not. And yeah, not everybody will pick that option. Not everybody will want to have the extra plan or whatever. It's fine. But you know what? A lot of us will. We know that because the PC world has had these for a decade. People buy them. It's like, this is not a hypothetical. It's been around for a long time and people buy them. And any argument you could possibly make about why the MacBook Pro shouldn't have cellular available, you can say the exact same thing about the iPad. And the iPad has had cellular on literally every model they offer since day one, almost 10 years ago. So clearly there's you know, some reason why they haven't wanted to put it on a Mac yet, but clearly it should be there if they can do it. And I just hope the time that they can do it is coming, because the need has not gone away. The need never will go away. And it's well past time. We are sponsored this week by Fracture, who print your photos in vivid color directly onto glass. Go to fractureme.com/ATP for a special discount on your first order. Almost all of us take photos, and usually what happens is we take the picture, it looks great on our phone, we post it online maybe, and then that's it, we never see it again. After a day, it's off the timeline. You almost never actually get those photos printed, and very few of them ever end up on display for you to actually enjoy. Let Fracture help you. Fracture lets you focus on the moments that mean the most in your life by turning your favorite digital photos into meaningful photo decor. Fracture prints are made by printing directly on glass. It looks awesome. Your picture looks great. The print goes edge to edge, and it's actually printed on the back surface of a thin piece of glass and kind of adhered to like a piece of foam core to help you be able to mount it into something. And so it's this beautiful, thin, edge to edge, very lightweight, complete thing. You don't frame it or anything. Like, it comes and that's it. It's totally its own unit. You don't have to, like, you know, get anything else for it. It even comes with the wall hanger in the box, so you really don't have to get anything else for it. It's ready to display right out of the box. And these prints look good on any decor because they're just little rectangles of glass that have your wonderful pictures on them. And we've used them. We have them all over our house. I have them in the office here. We actually make a little Fracture print square for any new podcast that we do. My wife and I, so there's like six or seven of them around the office right now. We give them as gifts. They make fantastic gifts because, you know, photos are great gifts, and photo prints really can convert a memory or an experience into a great gift for anyone in your family or friends. And Fracture is a really high quality company too. All their prints are handmade by real people in Gainesville, Florida. They use U.S. sourced materials. They're a green company, and they operate a carbon neutral factory. Check it out today at fractureme.com/ATP for a special discount on your first Fracture order. They will ask you where you heard about them. Don't forget to tell them you heard about them from ATP. So once again, fractureme.com/ATP for wonderful glass photo prints. Thank you so much to Fracture for giving us lots of gifts to give to people, decorating our house, and sponsoring our show.
Tell me about the Motorola Razr. So when I was a young lad, I had a Motorola Razr, and I loved that thing. I thought it was amazing. And apparently there's a new one now?
Speaking of cellular, yeah, we talked about, I think last show or a couple shows, we were talking about like foldable phones, but like they're regular size phones, but they fold the other way, like, you know, like a flip phone, like the Motorola Razr. Well, Motorola being the savvy/desperate business that it is, has a lot of brand equity in the Razr. Lots of people have fond memories of their Razrs, as does Casey, I imagine, because it was a cool, thin flip phone, right?
It's the only phone Motorola is remembered for.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good, there's also the StarTAC and stuff, but, you know, and there's a lot of brand equity in this, right? Unfortunately, the brand equity and everything about it is wrapped up in the idea that it is a thin phone that folds in the way that a Razr folds, right? So they are making a foldable phone that is very much like the size and shape and proportions of the original Razr, except that when you open it up, ta-da, OLED screen, a bendy OLED screen is inside there. And it's got one camera that is facing you when it's closed and is facing away from you when it's open. And it's got a chin just like the Razr and the whole nine yards. There's even like a weird nostalgia mode where it will put on the screen like graphics that look like the old Razr number pad and stuff above it and everything. I'm not sure if this is a good phone, but this is more or less exactly what I was talking about in terms of like that, the fun of making a phone that really does fold to be small and is fun to like flip open and close. So this is as good an attempt at that as I can possibly imagine, because it's got the brand equity, it's got the good feelings and nostalgia associated with it. The size and shape and form factor are nice in that they are very much like the thing that it is aping, but also are reasonable for a modern phone when it's open. Like it's not a ridiculous size and shape phone. It's not really skinny or really broad or whatever. The chin is a little weird, but this phone intrigues me. Obviously, the folding part is the most difficult part, and you still have the problems of if the screen dies because of the folding. And you know, if you look at the hinge, it's very similar to the other one. So I'm not sure if this is going to stand up to heavy use or how delicate it's going to be or whatever, and whether the sort of the usefulness of being able to make it that small makes that much of a difference. The biggest enemy of this phone is probably the degree to which our world and society has accommodated phones. I know on women's clothing, there continues to be a very terrible lack of reasonable size pockets. But in general, I think the trend in clothing for everybody is for the pockets to either A, start existing on women's clothing, if you're lucky, and B, be big enough to accommodate a smartphone, because we all do have smartphones. And if we buy a piece of clothing and find that our smartphones don't fit in any of the pockets, we will not have good feelings about that piece of clothing. So maybe the time of this phone is actually already passed and we don't need anything to get that small, but maybe it will appeal to people who still think phones are too large and awkward in their pockets. So I thought this is the most interesting folding phone that I've seen. Not that I want to buy one, but I want other people to buy them and see if they like it.
I don't think it's actually what anybody wants. Like, it's a cool nostalgia thing, but I don't think you're really solving a problem that people have by having the phone fold and get really thick.
But the Razr isn't that thick. That's what I like about it, is that it is, like, the whole thing with the Razr is, look, can you believe how thin this phone is? And this foldy one is also thinner than you would expect a folding phone to be. It's not thin, right? It's still thick, right? But
I don't know. Like, do people really need their phone to get shorter just in that one dimension but twice as thick? Like, it doesn't seem like that's the right dimension to be folding on. Not to mention, of course, I don't think for a second this is going to work. Like, I don't think for a second the screen is going to be like durable
hinge. The durability, yeah.
No,
yeah.
I think we're nowhere near the point where anybody has solved that. So I don't think for a moment this is going to last more than like three flips before you have a bubble on your screen or whatever. but even assuming that it did, I don't think this is solving a problem people really have today.
I mean, I know people do have problems with phones in pockets. I know, because I do. I have, like, there are certain pants that I wear that the phone fits okay in one pocket, but if it's in another pocket, I can't sit down because I'm afraid it's going to bend or, like, get damaged in some way, right? And I have relatively big, you know, man pockets, right? Women's clothing that has either fake pockets or ridiculously small pockets. Maybe this is literally the only phone that will fit in one of those pockets, because the problem is usually pocket depth and also, like, you know, how much it stretches out. Anyway, I don't know. Like, I don't think this is a super pressing problem, or more people would have been making smaller phones to begin with, and the trend is the opposite direction. And it could be that one of the reasons big phones became so popular is people find a place in their life for the big phone, whether they put it in their purse or they, you know, put it in their backpack or have an inside pocket on their coat or something. But I'm still intrigued by the idea, because the sort of monoculture of all phones being basically the same size and shape and us trying to accommodate them, I do find it a little awkward, because there's really no good place for an item that large in any of the typical pants pockets that people might have. And so you end up going in a bag or something like that. And I don't know. It's a problem I kind of sort of have. So that's why I'm not entirely willing to dismiss it. But I think you're right about the durability. And this is the first attempt at this. And I'm sure it's going to be a little wonky. We'll see.
I just think the folded state is too thick. I don't think people are actually going to want that.
Yeah, maybe. I was trying to look for what the measurements are. It doesn't look to me as thick as like the Galaxy Fold. Like, that's what I'm comparing it to in my mind. I'm comparing it to other folding phones. And it also doesn't look so thick that I think it would like stretch out your pocket uncomfortably. And it's like, well, it fits fine depth wise, but it's so thick. And of course, I say this is someone with a giant wallet, so maybe I'm not the best judge.
That wallet is gigantic. All right, let's finish up. Follow up, hopefully. And let's talk about my Catalina problems. So if you recall, I got my iMac back like a month ago and then pretty much immediately put Catalina on it after I gotten back from Disney World, which is just briefly after. And shortly after putting Catalina on it, I started noticing that my trackpad, which is my primary pointing device these days, would occasionally just ignore my input, and it would ignore clicks, and eventually those clicks would find their way to the trackpad, and it would be like a machine gun, and it would and fire all these clicks, all basically at once. And I asked, are people seeing this, or is it just me, and am I crazy? And oh my goodness, apparently I am very not crazy, or at least not for this reason anyway. And a lot of people reached out via Twitter and said, oh yes, not only are they having latency issues with their Apple mice, but a handful of people actually said that other brands, especially Logitech, Bluetooth mice were having latency problems. And then one person, Will Bishop on Twitter, wrote in to say that he has had the machine gun issue on his MacBook Pro's touchpad, which is deeply alarming. So I don't know what's going on here. I still maintain that I feel like it's a software problem based on no facts and just gut feeling, but I don't know what to do about this, and it's really, really bothering me. And it's bothering me to the point that I really am starting to feel like this iMac is now cursed, and I'm thinking about replacing it again. And so to move out of follow-up and perhaps into a new topic, tell me again why I don't just want to get a 16-inch MacBook Pro and just hook up a monitor to it and just be done. Because this way, I will always have my one and only computer with me all the time. I never have to worry about going back and forth, although truth be told, I don't typically have a problem with that. But still, it'd be nice to have everything right there with me all the time. The only real problem I have with this, and the ace in the hole that'll get you guys to convince me to stick with an iMac, is I don't have a good answer for Plex. I was casting around on Twitter to ask, oh, can I just get a Raspberry Pi and put Plex on that and have that serve, you know, my media to me? And people said, yes, as long as you're direct playing. That is to say, you don't have to, you know, change the format of anything that it's playing, because if you have to transcode and change the format of what's being played on the fly, the Raspberry Pi will fall on its face. And so I've been looking into some other alternatives, including the NVIDIA Shield, something like that.
Oh, yeah, don't do that. No.
Well, I'm exploring options, but in summary, and let me start with John. John, why don't I want a laptop again? Because I feel like right now a 16-inch laptop with a monitor may not be too bad. So talk me off the ledge.
Laptops are terrible.
That's not sufficient. I don't have those problems.
They make all sorts of noise. They get hot. You just like imagine using your computer but having to constantly hear some tiny little fan screaming. Yes, you can attach a bigger screen, but then you're constantly plugging and unplugging it, and then you just end up using the smaller screen, which is not as good. If you have to deal with pointing devices, then you've got these Bluetooth devices that you constantly have to, you know, repair or make sure are properly connected. A desktop is the right solution for a fixture in your house where you're going to do things on a big screen and for things that you want to run all the time, like Plex. Like, a desktop is the right solution. Now, your current desktop may be flaky, but the solution is not, I don't need a desktop anymore. It's like, say, if your BMW's engine exploded and you decide to buy a Jeep. That's what you're thinking of here. It's not the same thing. You may be upset with BMW, but it's like, does that mean what you want instead is a totally different kind of car that is nothing like the one you had before, and that will solve all your problems? That said, I don't think you shouldn't have a laptop. I just think you should have a laptop and also have a desktop. And if your current desktop is flaky or dying, I also think it's probably still software related. But anyway, get another better, newer desktop and let that be your desktop, and then also have a laptop, and there will be peace in your kingdom.
Yeah, and I mean, in a perfect world, I would just, where money doesn't matter, I would just buy an iMac Pro, and I would buy the 14-inch that doesn't exist.
You don't need an iMac Pro. You just wait for the next regular iMac revision where they make it better, and then just buy that one and have your new laptop with a good keyboard, and everything will be fine.
I guess. I mean, I don't know. I feel like I could just solve everything in one shot. I could just solve everything right now and just get the obscenely large 16-inch and then get a monitor, and then all my problems are solved, and so I want to watch anything on Plex. But
you'd have like this big, don't you remember what that was like? You got a desk full of cables, you got a docking station, it's like a Thunderbolt docking station or a USB one, and it's sometimes it's flaky, and you plug your monitor in, and so, like, I'm living that life right now. I have a 15-inch laptop that I plug into a monitor and a keyboard and a mouse, and it's not great. Like, I would prefer to have a desktop and a laptop, because sometimes you need laptops to carry your computer around. But when I go to my desk, I hate having to plug the thing back in. It kernel panicked twice this week so far, unplugging it, because I had the temerity to unplug it from my docking station while the lid was closed. And when I opened back up again, the thing is booting. So sometimes it's booting, and sometimes I get to see the cool multi-language kernel panic thing. Like, it's not a good experience. It's not as reliable, your computer aside, as a desktop, where the monitor is always attached. And the keyboard and the mouse don't go anywhere. They're always right there. I'm a huge desktop fan, and I think they are good things. And it's sad that your desktop is haunted, as we discussed last week. But I don't recommend that you go all laptop. I recommend that you get a desktop and a laptop.
I do want to say that I want to hear Marco's two cents about this. But
you will.
And I know I will. But I don't know. Like, maybe I think the biggest problem I have is my current thinking is I'll get an iMac Pro and I'll get like a 13 or 14 inch MacBook Pro. But that is thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars.
Stop getting dime sized nicks repaired on your expensive
I didn't
golf.
Pay for it. I didn't pay for it. It's okay.
You can just take that money. It's good for, you know. It's exchangeable for goods and services.
Yes, yes, yes. It's too late, but I do take your point. And, you know, I think the ace in the hole, which I think I'm probably taking Marco's line here, is, you know, this is for my work. And I don't mean that in the haha funny way. Like, legitimately, this is for my work. And so if I'm going to spare no expense, that's a reference, John, on anything, I should probably be sparing no expense on my computer or computers. But nevertheless, it just kills me to think of, you know, my current thinking of a $5,000+ iMac Pro and then like a $2,000 to $3,000 MacBook Pro.
Don't get an iMac Pro. What makes you think you need an iMac Pro? You don't.
And that's where I was going with this is, as much as I want an iMac Pro, do I really need an iMac Pro? I probably don't. And if I don't, then I can save myself some decent money. I haven't looked into this, but I would assume I can save some money.
But I would still recommend waiting for the next revision, because the 5K iMac is louder and shoutier and not as nice inside as the iMac Pro. So, like, presumably there's a revision coming to the plain old iMac eventually, and that one hopefully will learn many of the lessons of the iMac Pro, but still not be as expensive. So you might want to wait for that.
What if I get a Mac Mini, John? Is that okay?
No, because then you're just like, that would solve your Plex problem, but you still don't have like the, you know, the desktop, the place in your house where you can sit down, yeah, where your computer is always already there and already configured for you to be using it.
I hear you.
And yeah, also happens to be on all the time.
Yeah. And for the record, I don't want to buy a Mac Mini for Plex purposes, because it's just a tremendous amount of money for only Plex.
Yeah, now, no, don't.
Just to be fair, I use Plex all the time. Like, if there was anything I was going to spend money on, it would be, you know, making my Plex life happy. But hundreds and hundreds of dollars for a Mac Mini just to run a Plex server seems stupid. All right, Marco, you've been very patient. I appreciate it. So solve all my problems for me by spending my money. This is your favorite thing in the world to do. Now is your moment. Spend all my money, please.
I'm torn, honestly. I totally get your dilemma here. And I was, when you first posed this question, the answer I was drafting in my head was, just get the 16, just go all out, because you're right, it would solve a bunch of problems. it would create a few more. But it would solve some. I also ran through in my head, just get a Mac Mini. It doesn't even have to be a modern one. It could be an old one. Just get a Mac Mini for your Plex needs, and then that frees up your laptop for everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, like, you do often talk about getting work done while mobile. You talk about getting work done in the car when Aaron's driving on a longish trip. You talk about bringing your laptop to grocery stores to work, I guess, in the produce section. I don't know. you talk about going to the library with your laptop. Like, you talk frequently about taking your laptop out and actually doing, like, development work on it. So you're doing significant work on a laptop frequently. So a decent to good laptop has to be part of your setup.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. It's just so that's a given. You have to have a good laptop of some sort. The way that you talk about working in the car concerns me for a 15 or 16 inch.
Mm-hmm.
Could you, in the way that you frequently work in the car, would a 16 inch be able to fit on your lap and open up fully?
I think so. I think I'm also overblowing car work. It's not that often that happens. It just so happens I was in the middle of doing something when we needed to go somewhere. So I was like, oh, screw it. I'll just bring my laptop with me and do it in the car. I don't think you're overblowing grocery store, which, by the way, is in the little cafe area in the grocery store. But I don't think you're overblowing grocery store.
You're not just like sitting by the pile of avocados.
No. I don't live in California. You're not overblowing grocery store or library work, because I would say 1 to 2 days a week, pretty consistently, and occasionally more, I will go to a grocery store, or library, or even a Starbucks or something like that and get work done. So I 100% agree with you that a decent and or certainly better than what I've got laptop needs to be part of the mix. And unfortunately, the one I think I want is a 13-inch or 14-inch MacBook Pro that has the new keyboard. I really feel like that will tick the most boxes in the laptop side of the world. Now, I also agree with John, and I think this is where you're about to go, Marco, that I do actually really like having an iMac. I really, really do. It seems like it's almost redundant if I'm going to be getting a very new and very fancy MacBook Pro. But I feel like I can justify it as not entirely redundant if I'm willing to wait for the 13/14. I don't know how willing I am to feel it's redundant if I get a 16 tomorrow.
And that's the thing. So, John is right. Using a laptop as a desktop has a number of ways in which it sucks. And I do think that you should at least no longer have your current desktop. I think, yeah. You know, having an iMac is a great thing. Having your iMac might not be a great thing. So that, you know, you might want to revisit that at least. That being said, your current iMac in a, you know, relatively decommissioned state where you just keep it in the corner somewhere with the screen off could do everything a Mac Mini could do. Plex-wise and everything else, it's probably reliable enough for that, right?
Yeah, actually, that's such an obvious answer that I have to be honest, I didn't even consider that, you know, I could just leave this as a server in a closet or something. It's a very large, very unwieldy server, but it could serve that purpose if I really wanted it to.
Who's going to buy it after we've been talking about it like this?
It's so true.
Oh, you just so put true. A sign on it that says not haunted.
Yeah, right? That'll be fine. It'll be no problem.
So like, you know, so you do kind of have a Mac Mini already in the sense that you can just use your old iMac in that role as long as it continues to work well enough for that, which is probably a pretty long time. I think what you really have to decide is how great do you want your laptop to be? How big do you want your laptop to be? That's really it. If you want a really nice, fast, big screen laptop for the times that you do work on it, if the 16-inch size works for you, there's a pretty strong argument to just get the 16-inch tomorrow and be done with this and just, you know, have it and don't have a desktop and maybe get the LG monitor at some point in the future and have that be your desktop setup. But are you working a lot at your desk? It sounds like you are.
I am, yeah. I would say, again, 3 or 4 days a week I'm at my desk, and 1 to 2, very occasionally 3 days a week, I'll be doing work somewhere else. So if I were to optimize for anything, I should optimize for my desk.
Yeah, so it sounds like really the best combo for you is probably some kind of iMac and a 13-inch MacBook Pro.
Which is what I think as well.
Yeah, and the fact that you can't get the one with the keyboard that's any good for probably another 6 months or so, you're just going to have to wait, I guess. Or compromise on that and get the damn 16 and spend a little more than what you want to spend. Although, honestly, if you spec up a 13, it isn't that much cheaper. Honestly, like if you spec up a 13, you can do this on the current pricing today because you can be pretty sure the new one's not going to be cheaper. So you can go and say
except if I want like a 1 terabyte hard drive, that could be cheaper in the future as it is in the 16 now, right? Because because they doubled all the SSDs, like you said.
Sure. Okay. So here, let me see. So 2.4 quad core. You're not getting the low CPU. You're getting the good CPU. You're getting, let's see. So even if I just leave the CPU the same, 16 gigs of RAM, they come with 256. And you said you get a terabyte?
I mean, my Adorable is a half terabyte, and that's fine. So if this wasn't serving as an all-the-time computer, then it would probably be okay.
Okay. So let's assume they double this to 512 as well, which I don't think is a safe assumption, but let's assume that. Then just to go to 16 gigs of RAM, you're looking at $2,000 for the 13-inch today. Mm. And that's assuming that you don't want the fast CPU or the terabyte hard drive, SSD, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
If you went to the 16 for $400 more, you would get the bigger screen, the better speakers, the much bigger battery, 50% more CPU cores, and you could have it today. you could have it right now. Yeah. You could have that extra 6 months of working with it. So that those all have value. So you have to decide, like, if you're going to be spending something like $2,000 on a laptop anyway in 6 months, would you rather spend $2,400 and have it today and have it be better in a few ways? Admittedly bigger and heavier, but better in some pretty, pretty big ways. Not to mention that glorious screen space. Like, that's a pretty compelling option to just say screw it and do it now. Because this is part of your work. Again, it'd be different if you were on a super budget crunch and you weren't doing like professional paid computer work. Like, that would be different. That isn't your situation. So if I were you, I did just go and buy one, but I would strongly consider just getting the damn 16-inch today because the 14 or 13 that you want doesn't exist today. Won't exist for probably half a year, and in the meantime, you could be using this. The price difference, I don't think, is huge. The portability difference is significant, but that's up to you whether that matters or not.
Sure.
I will say, like when I was packing up my 13, when I was closing it down, packing it up for I sold it to somebody. I really miss that size. Like being a 16-inch user now for a week. Man, that is a great size, and in the future I might go back to it, but I'm super happy every time I type on the 16. I'm super happy that today I chose this, and I will gladly spend $2,700 to use this for the next 6 months instead of a butterfly keyboard. Yeah.
I also wonder, a couple of things I haven't considered is it's not like my Adorable will necessarily just, die in a puff of smoke. I mean, it will still be around if I really need the portability that much.
Use that as your Plex server.
as long as the keys continue to work on it. Hey, you don't need the keys if it's just your Plex server.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I don't think it would be quick enough. I know
you're
joking. It's
a very powerful CPU for transcoding.
Exactly. I mean, I would like to give this one to Erin, but it's not like she's urgently in need of a new computer.
She wants a computer with a broken keyboard. I'm sure she would love that.
It's better than one that's been underwater 4 times. But be that as it may, I don't know. I also wonder if maybe the right answer is I get the 16 and maybe don't get it as baller as I would have if it was my only computer.
Yeah, get the base model.
Either get the base model. I'm really struggling with the idea of 16 gigs of RAM, but we can argue about that another time. But either way,
I've been using it on my laptop for the last year and a half and all time before that until it was 8 gigs.
Yeah.
It's been fine. If you were going to go all out and make this your primary computer and you're doing all your Swift stuff and you're all that, yeah, then maybe I'd go with 32. But if you're going to commit to the plan of having a laptop and a desktop, don't spec up the laptop too high and don't make it too expensive. I think the base model $2,400 or the slightly up $2,700 one that I got, I think are really good buys for what you get. And if you keep it relatively reasonable, if you don't spec it up like crazy, I think that's the way to go, because the reality is, it sounds like, again, the right solution for you is probably a laptop and a desktop.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only question is whether you buy a laptop that's a bit more than what you need now, or whether you buy the ideal theoretical one, you know, probably 6 months from now.
I also wonder if I could pull a Marco, and which I, oh God help me, because I've made so much fun of you for this, but could I get the 16 now and understand I'm going to take a little bit of a bath on it, but resell it in 6 months when the 13 comes out?
Yeah.
You know, because if I treat it nicely, if I keep it well.
Don't spill too much water in it.
Don't spill too much water in it.
By the way, Black Friday's in like a week.
That's true.
Say, Casey, you know this intellectually, but I think it's my place to remind you of it once again. so it becomes top of mind. You are in a situation where you come on this podcast with the two of us and you ask us for advice about what you should buy. You should be immediately suspect of any advice that Marco gives that compels you to buy something immediately. And you should be suspect of any advice that I give that tells you to wait to buy. Because honestly,
thanks guys. Really
helpful. What position are we in? Marco is the guy who's always like, he's always going to say buy it immediately. He always buys it. And I'm waiting 10 years to buy a computer. So really,
literally,
like all of our advice is so massively like polluted by our sort of respective positions on these strange different strategies. And yet, it doesn't mean either one of us is particularly wrong. So I don't understand how you can even take any of our advice, because you have to add so much salt to all of it. It's like, oh, great. Marco's telling me I should buy immediately again. Oh, great. No way. John thinks I should wait.
No way. You're so right. So out of curiosity, Marco, you don't know, but if you were to just stick your thumb in the wind, how much do you think you could resell your exact computer for, which you paid roughly $2,800 for?
Yeah.
How much do you think you could resell that for at around WWDC this upcoming year?
Maybe $1,800 to $1,500 at the worst.
All right. So you're saying it would be about $1,000 to lease a laptop for 6 months.
Yeah. You generally figure, like, you know, if you're going to resell something like that, and if you're going to do it through, you know, relatively reasonable channels, you're going to probably lose 30 to 50%, basically. But you don't, like, if you spec up with certain options, you get less of that back on resale than, like, the base price. Upgrades shrink down way faster in their value.
Mm-hmm.
So that's yet another reason to stick with one of the lower models and not super spec it up too much. Because like right now, like if you were to, you know, go boost up to 8 terabytes for, I believe it's $2,600, something like that, which honestly is not a bad price for that, for what it is. And you were to resell that in 6 months, you wouldn't get $2,800 back for that 8 terabytes. You would get very little of that upgrade increment back. So again, stick to the lower ones. This is not a bad idea. This is not unheard of. People do this all the time. It's fine. Like, you could totally buy a 16-inch now and sell it in June and have lost maybe, you know, $800 or something, like something in that ballpark, which, mm-hmm. again, is not a small amount of money, but you will be getting value out of this that is directly related to your work. You don't have to do this. You can keep working on your adorable and your broken iMac until, you know, the springtime or whatever, and hope that a 13-inch comes out that is what you want. But that will then only solve your laptop problem. You will still have a desktop problem. It's like only one of these problems is being, you know, delayed here. Your desktop problem, I don't think you're going to have a quick solution on, because I don't think anything else is likely to be released this year. And they don't tend to update iMacs on such a short schedule. They just updated the non-pro ones, what was that, about four months ago or so, 3 or 4 months ago?
I think so.
So, like, you're not on a super, you know, soon schedule for the regular iMac. The iMac Pro seems to be, you know, Intel-related. Who knows when the next Xeons are out for it, and then who knows how long Apple will take to update to them, if ever. Those are two giant questions that I don't think we have any idea what the answers are yet. So, your desktop question is not going to be solved by a new product release in the near future, in all likelihood. So I would honestly strongly consider the previously considered option for the desktop, which is the refurb iMac Pro that is still in Apple's refurb store for $4,250. Not a bad computer for that price. If I were to have to buy a new desktop today, that is still what I would buy. Even after the Mac Pro comes out, if I had to make a quick replacement, I think I would still even buy the iMac Pro. in that scenario. It's that good. And it's that well suited to my needs. And I think you would appreciate it too, because as much as you say, well, I don't need a desktop, I don't need a super pro iMac Pro desktop, you do like a good desktop. The iMac Pro is a good desktop, and you do like your FFmpeg. You do a whole lot of transcoding and a whole lot of Swift UI building and stuff like that. Like, stuff that really is hard on the CPUs. I wouldn't say everyone I know needs an iMac Pro or would even benefit from one or would even notice the difference from a regular iMac to an iMac Pro. You would. It would also be likely to work for a little while longer than your current one, maybe. Yeah. So I still think for your desktop solution, I would still strongly consider an iMac Pro if you're going to have a desktop. For your laptop, I think it's a separate discussion. I honestly do. It's up to you whether you want to buy a 16 now or wait for the 13 with the good keyboard. But you need it now, and you won't take too much of a bath if you decide to buy it now and resell it later. So yeah, it's up to you.
Yeah. See, this is the problem with talking to you, because now I feel like I'm about to spend $7,000 on two computers.
Right, and then talk to John, you'll spend nothing.
Well, I appreciate the advice, guys. I'm going to make a decision on something soon, because this is untenable the way it is.
We are sponsored this week by DoorDash. Don't worry about dinner. Let dinner come to you with DoorDash. Whether you've had a long day at work or a tough day at school, you're still stuck at the office working late, treat yourself to the meal you deserve and have your favorite restaurants come to you with DoorDash. You still got to eat. DoorDash connects you to your favorite restaurants in your city. And ordering is super easy. You just open the DoorDash app, choose what you want to eat, and your food is delivered to you wherever you are. And not only is your favorite place probably already on DoorDash, but there's also over 340,000 restaurants in 3,300 cities, so you can probably also find a new favorite. And with door-to-door delivery in all 50 states and Canada, you can order from your local go-tos or choose from your favorite national restaurants like Chipotle, Wendy's, and the Cheesecake Factory. So don't worry about dinner. Let dinner come to you with DoorDash. Right now, you can get $5 off your first order of $15 or more when you download the DoorDash app, enter promo code ATP. Once again, that's $5 off your first order when you download the DoorDash app from the App Store and enter promo code ATP. Let dinner come to you with DoorDash. Thank you so much to DoorDash for sponsoring our show.
Let's do some Ask ATP, and let's start with Bastian Inuk, who writes, today I learned Amazon Prime Video, or parts of it, is built with server-side Swift. Bastian's question is, when is the language ready for server-side production, in our respective opinions? I'll start by answering this by quoting someone. I heard this on a podcast years and years and years ago, and it seems so obvious in retrospect, as all great ideas do. But somebody once said that you never want to be the biggest client of anything. You never want to be the biggest installation.
It was Marco who said that.
I know.
All right. I can never tell with you.
This time I knew. Right. There are many all times right. I do not.
Fine.
This time
I was about to yell at you, but you were just, it's fine. Okay.
No, I was setting it up, John. You took it from me. You stole it from me. Now
My faith in you is so shaken. how long am I going to let him go through this before?
I should be offended, but I don't blame you at all. Anyway, Marco, I don't remember. I think it was on Build and Analyze that you had said you never want to be the biggest client of anything. And I think that was really astute. And I think that's true. So as long as other people who are far, far bigger than you are using whatever the particular technology or language or what have you that you're looking at, then that's not, the get out of jail free card, if you will. But that's a really good litmus test to figure out, is this really working or not? And, if you hear about, say, Twitter using, say, Ruby on Rails, and you hear about it, say, failing constantly, maybe Ruby on Rails isn't quite ready. But since I've stolen your answer from you and parroted it back to you, Marco, do you have anything else you would like to add?
It depends on what your needs are. What are you trying to get out of your server-side language? Are you using something that you're mainly doing because, you love new languages and you're kind of a language nerd, or you're a Swift nerd, you want to use server-side Swift because you just like Swift so much, and it's more of an experimental thing or an exploratory thing or learning new skills? In that case, do whatever you want. It doesn't really matter. If you want something that scales easily, I won't use the word scalable, really, because scalable is not really a thing. It's how easily something scales, basically. Lots of languages can scale well or poorly, depending on the choices you make and the resources you have. It isn't that certain languages are scalable or not. It's just that, you know, certain languages make that easier or harder. So there's a question of that. But for me, with server-side languages, my server-side code exists as a supporting role to what I really want to be doing. What I really want to be doing is writing the app. And the last thing I want to be doing is messing around with my server stuff. I really don't like doing it. And I really don't like the idea of, you know, because server stuff kind of has its own schedule. It's kind of its own beast. And so server stuff can invent a need for attention at any time. You could be asleep or on vacation, or you could be really busy with something else. And server stuff can say, hey, I just exploded. Fix me.
Like my iMac.
And yeah. And so for me, I want my server stuff to be as low needs, low maintenance, high reliability as possible. And for that set of priorities, which again may not be your priorities, but for that set of priorities where my server stuff is really just like this kind of like supporting, you know, low profile task that I don't want my server stuff to be exciting. I'm not looking to learn a bunch of new things with my server stuff. I'm not looking for experimentation with my server stuff. I just want to do the most boring thing possible so it works and I can stop thinking about it. For that, I would say server-side Swift is still too young. It's changing too quickly. It's too young. And I would not use it yet because, again, my priorities are not, I love Swift so much and love new languages so much that I want to be cutting edge. Like, that's not me. I want my server code to go away. Basically, I want to write it and forget about it. And that's mostly what I can do with the old boring stuff I use. So again, it depends on your priorities, though. But those are mine. I would say that again, the not being the biggest user or something, very solidly good advice still, because you want to use the stuff that like Facebook and Wikipedia and like you want to use whatever big sites use, because it's just easier for you. You have tons of resources available to you if you have any questions. You probably won't have anything break. You probably won't be exceeding the capacity of anything. You know, you're not going to hit scaling limits in all likelihood with whatever you're doing if like Wikipedia is using the same thing and they aren't hitting the scaling limits. You know, so like there's all sorts of benefits like that. Also, big companies tend to use stuff that's a little bit old for all these reasons, right? Or because they themselves are old and they built their infrastructure back when these languages were new or whatever. And that's another huge advantage. Like if you're doing something that's old, it'll be included in repositories for Linux package managers. It'll have tons of Stack Overflow answers. Like it'll just, the tools will be mature. The frameworks won't be changing very often. The language won't be changing very often. Like there's huge advantages to all that. That if you really are writing server code to support something else you're doing and you don't want to be spending 100% of your job doing the server code, pick the older boring stuff. And Swift on the server is not that yet.
All right, old man, tell us what the real answer is.
So I see questions like this. I always think that like what they're looking for is like some kind of like line that a language has to cross or a litmus test to say this language is ready for server production. This ready is not. When is a language ready for server production? And there's not actually one answer to that question, especially in this day and age of, you know, public cloud scalable infrastructure and microservices and all the other things that are trends and you know whatever, but also are a fact of server side development life. In many cases, you could find yourself writing a service that's a small service that does a particular thing, and that certain languages are better suited to that particular thing than others. If the thing that you're doing doesn't need to be tremendously high traffic, if it does a simple task, if it can scale simply horizontally, if your main scaling problem is not the language, but is in fact the data store or whatever, you may find yourself looking at it. A weird language, a language that's not even used on the server too much. Hopefully you're looking at it because it has some characteristic that makes the thing that this particular server is going to be doing better, faster, easier, more efficient by some large amount. Not just like, oh, I think it's cooler and I want to try it or whatever. And cases like I'm describing actually do come up. If you say, well, you know, Facebook uses this, so I should use it, or Amazon uses this, so I should use it, you'll probably be fine, right? It's not like you'll have a big problem, but especially if you are a small business or a startup or a single person or somebody who, for whom money makes a difference, and especially if you're running stuff in the public cloud, which you probably are if you're, you know, a small person, using a language that can be 10 times more efficient in terms of, you know, CPU time, memory, or whatever, can save you actual money paying for your AWS bills or whatever. So if you want to use Go or Erlang or, yes, even Swift for your real production server that does this one simple thing that you have a really good reason to use it for, it may actually be worth dealing with the immaturity, the lack of tools, the lack of documentation, so on and so forth, as long as it is actually feasible. So I feel like the only line is, like, is it feasible to use this language, assuming all those other things I described are, like, correct, like that you actually are picking the right language for the job, it has real measurable advantages, and it's not just like your random personal preference. Although I would say if you're a single person shop, your personal preference and skill may actually be one of the dominant factors, because it's like, well, this is the language I know the best, and so I'm going to write the best thing in it or whatever. I've seen this happen in real world scenarios, and it's like, if the organization is healthy, it is right to question this. Why is it that you think you need to use Haskell? And those answers need to be convincing. But if those answers are convincing, it's usually not disqualifying if, like, well, nobody actually uses that on the server and the tooling is terrible. That may be true, but it may still be the right language for you. So what Marco said is, like, the writ large, like, you know, if you're going to just use this as, like, your blanket language or some big thing in a general scenario, that's fine. But I have, over the past, let's say, 7 years, become much more convinced that it actually is healthy and smart to actually suffer the slings and arrows of an immature language that, quote unquote, isn't ready for production if you have a specific single purpose for it. And with, like I said, with small services these days, you may find yourself in that scenario more often than you think.
Renee Ferguson writes, hey, Marco, do you have any way to track total listen time for an account in Overcast? I just finished listening to ATP's entire back catalog. My goodness, Renee, that must have been a trip.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm not sorry. You're doing it right, Renee. Good job.
Anyway, so Renee would like to know, having finished the entire ATP back catalog and with their previous podcasting habits, they're curious to know how much of their life have they spent listening to podcasts?
I can't tell you. I can tell you what Overcast saves on your, like, on the database table that saves, like, your episode progress, which is by far my biggest database table. It saves on each episode that you've interacted with, it saves the current timestamp and whether it's been completed, but it doesn't save how much time you spent listening to it. So, like, if you skip parts of it, I don't actually save that information anywhere. I don't know that, like, on the database level. So all I know is I can tell you, and actually you can see this for yourself. If you go to the webpage, if you go to the account section, you can export OPML in this kind of custom extended format that I implemented, so you can actually export all your data. That is all the data I have. That's it. I can tell you, like, a list of episodes you completed or you marked as played in some way with Overcast, but I can't tell you how much actual time you spent listening to them. Regardless, the answer to your question of how much of your life have you spent listening to ATP is probably too much.
Fair enough.
But I appreciate it.
As do I. And then Phil Tech, I think is how I'm supposed to pronounce this, writes, is it reasonable to assume that the release of these new Adobe iOS apps could be used as the basis for native applications on ARM-based Macs? Yeah, we're all waiting for that. You know, that's what's going to happen, isn't it? I'm going to buy the 16, and I'm going to resell it for the 13, and then 6 months after that, they're going to come out with the ARM-based Macs, and I'm going to be real upset.
Join the club. I'm going to be in that same boat, only I'm going to have a way more expensive computer without an ARM chip in it.
That is true.
Well, but again, that's all the more reason why, like, it's okay to buy one now that you don't spend a ton of money on, like, that you don't spec up like crazy. Buy the frickin' base model or the one right above it, and then you can still resell it for not that much money. And again, by the way, Black Friday is coming up in a week, and there's probably going to be some kind of, like, you know, get $100 or $200 off kind of deal. Just do it.
Yeah.
I can't even tell which one of us is the devil on your shoulder, Casey. You have two devils on your shoulders, and they're just in different outfits.
I was thinking, like, the angel and the devil on the shoulder thing. I also couldn't.
But then, which one is the angel?
Neither of you.
Yeah, like, I couldn't make the analogy because I couldn't figure out which one was
which. You're both so mean. No, I hear you. All right. Anyway, John, is it reasonable to assume that these Adobe iOS apps could be used as the basis for native ARM apps?
thanks to the specific wording of this question, the answer is yes. It is reasonable to assume that they could be used as the basis for native app. They absolutely could be, and that is reasonable, but they probably won't be. So it's not reasonable to predict that they will be. It is much more predictable that they will take the existing x86 applications and port them to ARM, just the same way they ported them from 68K to PowerPC to Intel, yada, yada.
I will say there is probably somewhere, like some part of the effort for Adobe to bring their like, you know, quote, real apps to iOS, some part of that effort had to be removing any remaining assumptions in the code about, you know, code architecture and instruction sets and byte ordering and stuff like that. Now, granted, again, you mentioned, you know, the PowerPC transition happened. So, like, they probably already went through a lot of that. But they could have still had some of that in there that was added maybe since the Intel transition for new types of features or new engine modifications that were like custom optimized just for Intel, just for x86, whatever. And so if they have modernized a lot of that code or gotten rid of those assumptions for the ARM build of like the core code for various things, that would still help an ARM transition on the Mac as well. But I don't think we really know enough about the state of their code before and whether that kind of thing still had to be done to really say for sure whether it has any relevance here.
But we know like the UI of the iOS ones is not the full UI. So as the right. basis of, I feel like it's saying like you're going to start a project. You're going to start from the desktop app, right? But of course, whatever components that are at the core that they're, you know, messing with or whatever. Although I imagine at this point, having done so many ports of different architectures, what they're actually doing when they do the ARM thing is finding the place where this platform-specific code and adding an ARM implementation of it. Like, I really hope at this point, after two architecture transitions, there isn't code lurking somewhere in the core of Photoshop engine that relies... Because what we rely on, like, someone accidentally re-added something that relies on PowerPC or relies on Intel. I really hope that's not happening, but who knows? But anyway, as the basis of makes me say, like, where are you starting from? And I think they're going to start from the desktop version of those apps because there's just so... It's the desktop version is what's going to be on the desktop version of the ARM Macs too, right? It's going to be that.
Thanks to our sponsors this week, Linode, Fracture, and DoorDash, and we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYL. ISS, so that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRAC, USA Syracuse, it's accidental.
We're not going to talk about that terrible Trump and the Mac Pro Factory thing, are we?
Not unless you want to.
I don't want to, and that's all I want. I want to have said that we addressed this, but it's gross, and I don't want to think about it.
All right. Well, by saying it's gross, you've now addressed it. Good job.
Thank you.
Yeah, and concur.
So I'm curious. In the notes, it says John is preparing the way, and I think this is a reference that I actually get for the first time.
Yeah,
ever.
I did not, and you did.
Yeah, this. I assume this is a reference to the Rectif's famous refrigerator episode, which for anybody who has not heard it, it is a masterpiece, and you should hear it.
It is.
Where,
it absolutely is.
As John is preparing for the delivery of a new refrigerator, he has to prepare the way in his house of, I guess, getting the old refrigerator out of the way and preparing the house to have the fridge enter through it. So, John, it says you are preparing the way. Am I to assume that you are preparing the way in your office for the new Mac Pro?
You are correct, and I'm surprised Casey didn't get that because we've actually talked about this on a past episode, how this was a thing that it was going to happen. It's happening. It is now happening. It's a little bit of yak shaving involved in that, like, I'm starting to sort of stage my purchases, right? You don't want to wait until last minute. You don't want to wait until like any day, once December starts, the order form could be up and then the process begins of me trying to figure out, but who knows? I didn't want to like have the Mac Pro arrive and not have the way prepared. You know, I need to, this is the time to reconsider all of the things that are connected on above and under my desk, because everything must go and the new thing is coming in. Does anything stay? Do I keep any component of my old system? If not, what do I replace it with? And there's a lot of components besides the computer and the monitor. You've got the mouse, the keyboard, all of the power accessories, the little power strip things, the UPS, the various tables and chairs. And what about the whole desk? Maybe I need a whole desk. Like I joked about, need to get a new house for my Ferrari or whatever. But like, this is the time to consider it. This setup has been here since I moved into this house, 18 years ago or whatever. If I'm going to reconsider something, now's the time to reconsider it. I'm also, by the way, part of this reconsideration. I don't think I mentioned this on a past show or maybe a really long time ago. My Mac Pro is sitting on the floor right now to my left, as you do with a tower computer. For a long time, my Macs were always on my desk. Even when I had tower Macs, I had one of those fairly awful, what model was it? Was it a Quadra? It was one of those Quadras that wasn't really a Quadra, I think. Or maybe it was still a Performa. That I thought there was a Q in the name. Anyway, I can't even remember. But it was a tower, and it was on my desk, because that's where my computers had always been. Like, it used to be the monitor was built into the computer, so of course it would be on your desk, and even, you know. Anyway, when I got my blue and white G3, it was on my desk to the left of my monitor. Apple would display it that way. When they showed, the advertising stuff, they would show the blue and white G3 next to the weird monitor that matches it, and they'd be right next to each other. Like, they're both on your desk. Let's see what else I had on my desk. I think when I got my Power Mac G5, which was looked very much like the cheese grater, but in different ports and stuff on it, I tried putting that on my desk. I was like, no, it was just too, the power supply was squeaky, the fans were too noisy, and it was just monstrous. Like, it was bigger than the blue and white G3 that it replaced, right? And since then, my computers have been on the floor. But the floor is a dangerous place for a computer. Lots of things happen on the floor. Children are on the floor. Things roll around on the floor. The chair is on the floor. Vacuum cleaners are on the floor. Lots of things potentially whizzing by near or towards your computer. My Mac Pro, as I think I've mentioned at least once before, has a big, shiny kind of chip taken out of the sort of the side case that extends past the front, right? That little piece right there. It's shiny because it's like it's anodized aluminum, but it's been dented and sort of like messed up in such a way that that now it's like the shiny aluminum is shining through. Pretty sure that was a vacuum cleaner strike or a meteor strike or something. It's upsetting. The prospect of my umpteen bazillion dollar shiny new Mac Pro with special machined weird holes that make people grossed out on it getting dinged by a vacuum cleaner bothers me. So part of preparing the way is I was thinking, where is this new computer going to go? Is it going to go on the floor right where my old computer is? Maybe if it had wheels, I was thinking the wheels, I could like wheel it out of the way better when the vacuum comes along or something. But like, I don't know. So I don't think I'm going to put it on my desk because it's still pretty big. I was looking at the measurements. It's not as big as the cheese grater, but it's still pretty big. So I probably don't want that on my desk, although it really does depend on the fan noise. To the left of my desk, since I moved in here, has been a tray table. Tray tables that we got when we were married, because I guess you need tray tables, and they are very useful. And it's been there because it was like a little table that fit, like my desk doesn't extend all the way from like the bookcase on one side to the wall and the other. There's a little space and it's just big enough for the tray table. And I put it there when we moved in, mostly on a whim. The UPS is below the tray table. On top of the tray table is like my headphones and like one of my camera bags and some spare cables and various other things are on, and it's useful. It's useful to have a little bit extended desk space. It is lower than my desk, which is also nice because you can kind of pile stuff there and the piles don't, extend up over the desk area. What I was thinking is, well, I got to get rid of that tray table because I feel like it's not the right tool for that job. And also I'm looking at new UPSs and I don't think any of the new UPSs I want will fit under the tray table. So I probably need a new table there. But once I get a new table, could I put the tower computer on that table? And if I put it on that table, could I get a lower table so the tower isn't like towering over me, but also isn't on the floor? So that's what I'm considering. So as we're sitting here now, to my left is a new table that's not a tray table. It's like a piece of furniture that more or less matches my desk. It does not fold, right? With four sturdy legs, like it's not, you know, it's stable. It is a viable platform for the new Mac Pro, according to the measurements on Apple's website. So I could, and it's a little bit lower than the old one was, so I could put my Mac Pro there, keeping it out of the way. More importantly, this one has enough room for the very large UPS I just bought, which is much larger than the one that it is replacing. I bought a UPS that has fans in it, fearing whether, you know, is this going to be a problem or whatever. But I bought it saying, look, I'm going to buy it. This is preparing the way. Order it now. Buy it. Do all the research. I've done, you know, all the research and looked at all the videos for all the stuff. Like, this stuff that is in my house now, I've been researching for, like, I don't know, a month. Like, at my leisure, right? Finally got to the ordering point. So I got the UPS. I set it up. I plugged it in. Dead silent, or my ears are terrible. Either way, like, I'm happy, right? So there you go.
Well, I think usually, don't the fans usually only run when it's running on battery? Because I think they're blowing on the inverter or something.
Yeah, that's usually the case. But it's not actually true that they only ever run when it's on battery. They run when it needs them to run. Like, they're temperature sensitive, and as soon as you go on battery, yes, of course they kick on. But it's also possible, depending on the model, for them to be running when you're not on battery. If they are running when it's not on battery, I can't hear them. It's like the router that you sent me. That has fans in it that are running all the time. I literally can't hear them. So one of the few joys of aging, I cannot hear these fans. So
nice.
That passed my test. This is a, what is it? It's a 910 watt maximum UPS, which is vastly more capable than the one it's replacing. I tried to do, as I always do, like the watt calculation for like, worst case scenario, the Pro Display XDR plus the Mac, and try to figure out, and then plus, you know, my speakers and whatever the hell else I might have plugged in over here, and how much would that draw? And I just, it's just like, you know what, just buy the biggest one. So I did. So I've got that. Also, all of my various surge protectors and power strips for things that I don't have on a UPS, like my speakers and stuff, where I don't, you know, it doesn't need to be on a UPS. And in fact, it probably shouldn't, because those things tend not to, behave well on the simulated sine wave that the crappy UPS has put out, although mine is a fancy sine wave one, so it's nicer. Anyway, I need all new power strips. I need all new little cables that adapt from the weird position that the UPS power things are pointing out to have the cables go in the right direction so I can plug all of the things in. And then there's stuff back there that I don't even know about. I have some cases full of optical media. Remember that? I have like folio cases of optical media when I used to back up on optical media, and I still keep it around down here because occasionally I need to pull something from like a really old disc, and I have this big catalog of where they are. All this stuff is open for reconsideration. Luckily, the chair situation is handled. We covered that on the show already. Mouse and keyboard are still an issue, and I'm still researching. Keyboard, worst case, I just keep using my current one. Mouse, I really think I do need a new one. We mentioned that before, but I just wanted to let everyone know that this process has begun. And I don't want to tell you how much money I've spent already preparing the way, but I'm also going to say that I'm not going to count it in the calculation of, like, how much did this whole system cost you?
Here we go.
The reason I'm not going to count it is because, look, every 18 years, it's okay to reconsider the furniture and part of your house. I think that is a reasonable thing to do. And this same furniture has been here. I already reconsidered my chair, and I'm not counting that as part of it. So anything I do in terms of like, oh, you bought new cable extender thingies, you bought a new UPS, like, this is things that had to happen anyway. I bought a new UPS for my old Mac Pro at least twice, and I didn't count that towards the price of the computer. So I'm not counting this towards the final calculation, but it is also a non-trivial amount of money that I spent on stuff.
Oh, John.
That's awesome.
It is. I'm very excited about this new UPS, because for many years,
something no one's ever said.
Of course you are.
For many years, I was like, I'd look at the fancy UPSs and I'd be like, yeah, but they all have fans and they're so big. Like, do I want something like that big? I'm like, I can probably get away with a cheap UPS. So as I mentioned on past shows, I have a massively undersized UPS where if the power goes out, I have to, as I said, panic shut down. Like, oh my God, power's out. Because there is no time. Like, this thing can barely keep my Mac Pro running when it's like not particularly stressed. My Mac Pro and my monitor are way beyond the potential power capabilities of this UPS. And I always wanted a more powerful one, but they're expensive and they're big and they had fans and I was afraid of them. And so I finally overcame my fear as part of the, you know, like when you buy a car and you somehow find it palatable to pay an extra $500 for some stupid option because the whole damn car is so expensive, like that whole relative price anchoring thing, that is totally happening with the Mac Pro. And I'm like, well, if ever there was a time to consider buying a very expensive UPS, this is it. And honestly, it wasn't that expensive. Like the cheaper ones, it was like, it wasn't even twice the price of the cheaper ones. So I figure this is money well spent. And, you know, the sine wave thing, I did all the research on that and everything. I was like, I don't really need it. I'm not running like audio equipment off of it or a CPAP or whatever. Like, don't really need it, but doesn't hurt. And it's kind of cool. That actually took the most research. That the two things that took the most research were the UPS and then the little dongly cable things that you use to like basically redirect an outlet that's awkwardly placed or whatever.
Like the,
the power strip thingies.
Oh, yeah.
Like pigtails. The power strips. Power strip is the worst. That's the one thing that I got. The power strip just arrived today. Like just a plain old power strip that I'm going to plug like my speakers into and like other stuff that doesn't need to be on the UPS. Trying to find a good quality one or whatever. And I needed ones where the plugs are rotated 90 degrees to the strip. And I found one on Amazon. I order it, take it out of the box. The plugs are not rotated 90 degrees.
What?
They're the other direction. Right. So if you look at any power strip, just go to Amazon type power strip.
Yeah.
All of the ports like are vertical, like the three prongs. It has two and then one on the bottom, and then two and then one on the bottom, like right down the strip. Right. And I found one where they rotated 9 degrees and I bought it. Picture on the site just lies. It's just wrong. It's from the same company. It is the same color. It is the same size. What? It is the same shape, but the ports are just rotated. And so and it was cheap. It was like, you know, it's just a power strip, whatever. So I was going to, I'm like, oh, I got to return this. But it's like, you know what? You could always use a new power strip. Like, this is a thing we've talked about before. Surge strips, like, they do wear out. So if you have one in your house that's been there for 18 years, you should probably just replace it anyway. So what I'm going to do with this one that's wrong is I'm going to replace it. But I did try to contact Amazon and say, just so you know, the graphic on the page for this item is wrong. That's not what you're shipping. Like, it's not it at all. There is a model like that, but that's not what you're shipping. So I tried to find the place where you do that. I just wanted to do it with like web chat. I didn't want to call anybody.
Oh, forget it.
What I was So I found a web chat thing and it's this weird, you know, automated system where I'm not talking to a human yet. Not only am I not talking to a human yet, I'm not licking toads. I'm not talking to a human yet, but I can't type anything. The only choices I have at the bottom of the little window are bubbles with selected text, essentially buttons, right? And so the first one is, would you like to talk about an order, like, you know, about a return? Like, there's a bunch of options. It's like a phone tree, but they're presented as text bubbles. So when you click one, it goes into the chat window as if you'd said that, but you didn't. You're just picking buttons. It is a phone tree in graphical form.
Oh, God.
So I go through that, and I get to the point where I'm saying it's about an order.
Even their bots don't want to talk to you.
Yeah, it had some good aspects because when I go through the thing, it's like, yeah, because this is like a new low of like, you know, just some poor person in a call center doing 20 chats at once, like giving you 1/800th of their attention, right? But at least that is a real human. This is a phone tree, right? The only good thing about it was like it's about an order, but I said, okay, what order? And it presented me with a graphical list of my recent orders. I'm like, this is so much easier than me copying and pasting the order ID, which I had already done, of course. I just clicked on the item. I clicked on the specific item within the order. So now they know exactly what I'm talking about. I don't have to like send them the URL or anything like that or whatever. And then I get to the point where it's like, do you want to return this or get a refund? And I didn't. I didn't want to return it. I didn't want a refund. I just wanted to tell them you have the wrong picture for this listing. And eventually I get to the point that says, all right, what's your problem? Type your problem here. And I type up my thing. You know, it's like two or three sentences about what the problem is. And I send it, and it says, okay, so now do you want a refund or to return it? And no, I didn't. So I pick the no option. It's like, well, this interaction is done. Thank you.
Yeah, see, have you returned stuff to Amazon ever?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Because I think if you did, you would probably know that it sounds like it was literally just taking you through the return flow because it asks you as like one of the return options is why you're returning it, and it'll give you the option of like that the website description was inaccurate. And I think that is that's what you are actually reporting.
It did give me that option. I did the bubble that said item was not as described or whatever. Like that's the one I picked. And then it let me type freeform text to say what the specific problem was. But then it wants me to say, okay, now we're going to give you a refund. And it says, but it had an option. It's like, do you want to do a refund or do you not? And I said, not. And it said, okay, we've logged this case and blah, blah, blah. And like all this, you know, so I think my feedback was quote unquote received, just not by a human. And that's the not reassuring part. I would have liked some human interaction for some human to say, okay, we'll put this in the bucket where we put in all of the complaints about item not as described. I'm assuming that's where it's going anyway. Anyway, to find what I should have done in the first place is what I usually do is I bought one of these strips for like my wife's iMac when we got it. I was replacing her surge strip thing there. It does have 90-degree plugs, and I found that exact model in her past orders. Amazon doesn't have it anymore, but I bought it from a different place by the model number, and so, you know, it was cheap, and I got it.
I will spend a lot of time researching a lot of things. I've never spent this much time and effort on a power strip.
Yeah, you should have seen how much time I spent on the little pigtaily things. That was the worst part.
I have like a drawer of those in my garage. Like, I just...
Well, so here's the thing. Like,
they're wonderful, but, I mean, they're all the same, right?
You know what expensive UPSs look like? You know, like, expensive UPSs are differentiated from the cheap ones? They're differentiated. It's weird. They're differentiated the way like computers used to be. Like, cheaper desktops were like flat on your desk, but the towers were the fancy ones. So the slightly fancier UPSs are all tower form factors. And instead of the plugs being on the top or the sides, they're on the back, like where the ports would be on a tower computer.
See, I actually don't like this very much because the like good UPSs in recent years seem to have gone from basically like two car batteries next to each other in like a big rectangular like Velveeta shaped log to tall skinny towers. And the big Velveeta shaped log was awesome because you could use it as a footrest under your desk. You turn it sideways and it was so freaking heavy that you could like, you know, put your feet on it and push back and lean back mm-hmm. without the footrest itself moving at all.
I do not endorse this practice.
I did it for years. It was wonderful. I had mm-hmm. this giant like, you know, enterprise grade APC UPS that I got on some like, you know, clearance site, you know, forever. Like it was like out of date when I got it, but it was fine. It worked fine for years. And I had that awesome, just like car battery block under my desk that I could just use as a footrest for years. That eventually died. And I replaced it with some, you know, cyber power thing that is a very nice UPS, but is more of like a skinny tower. And you can't do anything with that except just leave it there. Like you can't use that as a footrest at all.
Yeah, I've never had it under my feet, and in general, one of the criteria for my setups is no power thing should be in reach of my feet, because
probably for the best.
You can absentmindedly kick out plugs, kick switches, like I shouldn't even be able to reach them. So then you don't have to worry about that, because you'd be surprised what your feet do when they're idle. They can mess with things. But yeah, those skinny towers.
For the record, all of my power things are within easy reach of my feet, and that has never happened.
Yeah, you obviously don't have like power strips with one of those little switches right on top of it, because that's, well, maybe your feet can't reach it. I keep making short jokes. I'm sorry. yeah, I understand the footrest thing too. It is good to have footrest, but I think there's better dedicated things for feet rests if that's what you need.
I have one now. It sucks. It just scoots around because it's like what I have now is basically like a half log cushion. It's like a semicircle extruded. And it's just like a cushion that scoots around on the floor, and it has like little like, you know, rubber dots on it that are supposed to keep it in place, but it doesn't work.
You need like one of those wedge shaped things, rubberized wedge shapes, the wedges that doesn't move.
It has like the rubberized thing on the bottom, but it's you know, I mean, I've had it for a number of years now, so I think the rubber is all like covered in dust, and now it just slides around.
Hmm. Yeah. Anyway, those plugs in the back of the little skinny towers, that's like the worst place to put a plug. It's not easy to get to the ports on the back of a tower. Why are you hiding them? Like they should be. The other ones where they were flat and they had the plugs all over the top, you could get at all of them easily. So this is the one thing I don't like about the expensive UPSs, but I can solve that by these little pigtail-y things that some of them duplicate ports where they will put a little thing into the plug and on the back of them will be another plug so you don't lose that plug, but then you have a little thing snaking off it, which you have to be careful with because the UPS can only handle a certain number of things in a certain... Anyway, assuming you manage all that, it's convenient. And then they have other ones that like are different angles, and you need some to come out of one side, some to cut out of the other. Like, it's a complicated thing. And the thing about these little pigtail-y things is you can find tons of them, and they're super cheap, but you want to get one that is good and rated for the power you're going to put through it, and is, you know, high quality and tight-fitting and, you know, complies with all the actual regulations. That isn't some weird, random, unspecified rip-off thing from some no-name company, right? So that's why it requires a lot of research, because it's like I'm looking for like the most expensive option, right? Like I do not want to buy from a company that I've never heard of for some random things that's going to come out smelling like chemically plastic and looking flimsy. Like that can't be the link between my horrendously expensive computer and my slightly expensive UPS. So I did spend a lot of time on that. Wow. And we'll see if I did a good job. I have, I think, all the pieces I need. I haven't started tearing out the old one because I don't even have a new computer on order, but the process is underway.
Are we still under the delusion that you're not getting the Pro Display?
We don't know yet. It's a mystery. We're in a period of uncertainty.
I mean, I'm certain.
Yeah, same.
Only you are uncertain.
No, that much is clear, but you are not the person making the purchase, so that certainty does not count for much. And I believe my wife is also not certain at this point. So,
see, now that
for a variety of reasons. The family, let's say, is not certain how much money I will be spending on this computer.
Like, part of the reason why I'm pretty certain I'm not ordering myself a Mac Pro is because of that display, because the only way to do it is to do it right. The only way to do it is to get the freaking Pro Display XDR.
If you're Marco,
the full $7,000 configuration with anti-glare and the stand. That's the way to do it if you're going to do it at all. And I don't want to do that, so I'm literally just going to not do it at all.
Maybe you need two of them for your new laptop.
Or obviously, yeah.
How could you not?
How could you not, Casey? You're going to be the one buying it.
Oh, no. I am not getting that $7,000 display. No, sir.
Just think, you could have a really awesome, mediocre desktop by having a laptop plugged into that display. You could have a $7,000 thing that flakily wakes up in kernel panic when you unplug it when it's in clamshell mode.
How many MacBook Pros could I buy for the $7,000 I would hypothetically be spending on the display?
Three. Do you think $7,000 buys a reliable clamshell experience?
Oh, no. No, absolutely
I don't think so either.
This is the ultimate luxury that none of us can afford.
It's not available at any price.
It's true, because laptops stink.